Welcome, everyone. The webcast is about to begin. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Good morning, everyone. This is Helen Imbrunino. I'm the Director of Quality at National Quality Forum, and I have the privilege of welcoming you to this morning's breakout session discussing measure implementation in office-based practices. We are in a conference room with about 17 or 18 people, and we also recognize we have a number of folks joining us via the web. I have a little bit of housekeeping for those people in the room, if you can bear with us, and then I'm going to turn it over to our track leaders, Kendra Hanley, Dr. John Macy, and Dr. Michael Marrow. In terms of the folks in the room, we are remote from the rest of the conference. As you noticed, we went down some elevators and up some elevators. There are restrooms outside this conference room. There are keys on the wall. You need to go all the way to the other end of the corridor. Ladies' room is on the right. Men's room is on the left. We will be trying very hard to balance participation between the folks that are in the room and the folks who are joining us via the web. We would like, if you have a comment or a question and you are connected to us via the web, for you to raise your hand on the screen and we will call on you. Given the complexity of folks in the room and coming in remotely, we're not going to be able to respond to questions that are typed in. So please raise your hand and we will call on you. With that, I turn the conference over to Kendra, who will kick us off, and we look forward to hearing some delightful presentations. Thank you.
Helen, so thank you, everybody, for being here today. I thought maybe we could start by going around the table and doing some introductions so that we have a sense of who everybody is in the room and kind of what your role in, I guess you could say, the quality enterprise or healthcare enterprise. Is, and then, Helen, do we have a sense, we probably want to do the same on the phone, right, at least, and do you have a sense of how many participants we have on the phone?
It looks like we have about 7 or 8
okay.
Web-based participants.
Great. So we'll do introductions, and then we have two presenters, Dr. Marianne Marty Pfeiffer, from Pennsylvania, and we also have Dr. Mike Nero. And then Dr. Mace, you're on the phone as well. So if you have anything you want to type in, please do. My name is Kendra Hanley. I'm with the AMA convened Physician Consortium for Performance Improvement, the PCPI. We're one of the major quality measure developers for measures that are out there in use in national programs. I work specifically on the development of the e-measure and e-specifications for the quality measures that are developed by the PCPI. And so our team works on developing those and then maintaining those over time, and also developing specifications for any new measures that are our area at PCPI work
on. Dr. Mike Miro, practicing electrophysiologist in Indiana. I represent also the American College of Cardiology. I sit on the National Cardiovascular Data Registry Management Board, which is involved with registries, cardiovascular reporting registries for ICDs, PCI at the hospital level, but then an ambulatory registry called Pinnacle, which is an ambulatory registry. Also sit on the Quality Improvement Committee for Heart Rhythm Society and chair their informatics group.
Hi, I'm Mike Sackett from Booz Allen Hamilton. I am a program manager working with a team from the AMA and NCQA, measure developers, and ONC to develop measures, specifically a few of the new ones that, as far as I was talking about, for meaningful use too, and moving forward to meaningful use.
Hi, I'm Kelly Miller. I'm currently at MedPAC, but about to move to the Integrated Healthcare Association, which is a group in California that's been running their physician pay for performance program for the health plans out there since 2002.
Scott Weinberg, I'm with the American Academy of Dermatology. I'm primarily responsible for translating PQRS to our members and implementing it through their office. It's a fun job. It's wonderful. Working here, so I totally understand that.
I'm Kara Webb with the American Optometric Association. My work is kind of similar to yours, helping our members with PQRS, meaningful use, and also our liaison to NQS and also the PCPI.
I'm Kristen Fessel with the Oncology Nursing Society. We are starting with quality measure development for symptom-focused ambulatory specialty measures and very interested in talking with this group because people are using them. Most chemotherapy is given in the outpatient setting. We're having a really hard time in our pilot testing with people who have some data in paper, some data in EHRs, but they still have to manually extract it, and it's been a real smorgasbord of challenges.
Hi, I'm Morty Pfeiffer. I'm with Lehigh Valley Physician Group in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I'm a family physician and also an active member of AMIA.
I'm Rebecca Swinning. I'm with the American Academy of Neurology and a senior manager with quality measurement implementation, dealing with development of neurological measures and implementation in practice and people performance programs.
Hi, everyone. I'm Susie Leah. I'm with the American Society of Hematology, senior manager for quality and practice there. So I'm responsible for TQRS measures, e-measures, we'll use all the various federal government programs and trying to help our physicians comply with those programs. We have 4 hematology measures, but they're not e-measures yet, so I'm really here to learn how to make that. At least try to start to learn.
I'm John Morrow from GE Healthcare. I'm a physician informaticist and an OBGYN. At GE Healthcare, I'm the director of the Medical Quality Improvement Consortium, which is our small to medium-sized practice EMR-based quality reporting system, and I'm senior medical leader for the group.
I'm Jennifer Birch. I'm with the American Urological Association. We're just revamping our quality arena, so right now we're trying to get into measure development more, specifically e-measures.
I'm Sean Evans with National Quality Forum. I work in the Strategic Partnerships Department and have just been asked to come here and help be your note taker and administrative assistant today. Can we hear from the folks who are on the phone? Oh.
And I also walked in a second late. I'm Will Underwood. I'm a senior associate at the American College of Physicians, and I work in kind of health IT and kind of quality improvement. I do all of the support for our practices and educational material in health IT.
Okay, who do we have joining us by the web and phone? Not ours, but
there. Yeah,
I don't.
They
should. They'll technically
yes.
Find out
yes.
What our problem is. If you can hear me, we will check back in with you as soon as we're sure the phones are live, but we're going to get rolling because we have a lot of material to cover in a relatively short period of time.
So I would recommend we just jump in. We have 2 presentations. So we'll ask Marty, Dr. Pfeiffer, for you to go first.
Sure. May I interrupt for just a moment?
Sure.
As folks are listening, the output that we're really looking for from this session is 3 things. As you're listening to the vignettes and as you're thinking about the environments that you come from or the environments that you've visited, if you could be thinking about identifying best practices relative to e-measure implementation. In addition to that, if there are obvious gap areas that jump to mind, we'd like to capture those so that we can document them and begin thinking about how to address them. And lastly, if there are specific recommendations that you would like to bring forward about how to move this work, particularly in office-based environments, forward, we would also like to capture those because they will become fodder for us for our continuing collaboratives and continuing discussion about the work that we're doing around e-measure implementation.
Helen, can we interrupt for a minute just to see if that's anyone?
Anthony?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm just wondering if anyone has dialed in to the call.
Yes, ma'am. We have 1 participant line. I do apologize. It looks like he actually just disconnected, but his line was open.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so right now no one is there?
That is correct. We have currently we have no participants on the phone.
And when they're on the phone, are they live? Can they talk to us?
Yes, ma'am. All lines are open when they're placed in.
Okay, fine. Okay, thank you.
So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Pfeiffer.
Oh, sure. My name is Marty Pfeiffer. I'm going through the introduction, so that'll be a little bit easier. I'm from Lehigh Valley Physician Group, which is in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We're a 750 provider group, 500 physicians, 250 advanced practice clinicians. So we see about 1.5 million visits per year, have 110 sites. My role is as a family physician and then also as a clinical physician. So my hope is to tell you a bit of what we've done and what we've learned, and then hopefully we can learn together about this initiative. So what we've done basically is we've built a variety. You can go ahead to the next slide. Thank you. We have a variety of quality and operational metrics, which we distribute routinely to our providers and advanced practice clinicians, office managers. We've realized, I think, early on that this is a team model, that we need everybody to be engaged. We have a couple rules when we have our quality or operational metrics, and they are really, it has to be an evidence-based measure, so it has to be the e-measures that we're abiding by. And we abide by them pretty exactly. We abide by them exactly. So if somebody says, well, you know, hemoglobin A1C, you know, we say less than 8, not less than 7, or less than or equal to, there's no ambiguity. We do the exact measure. And that's helped us out a lot when we try to repurpose our data for things like PQRS submission, et cetera. We try very hard to push our measures out rather than have people request them. So we decide organizationally what would be best for us, and we push the measures to all of the practices, even if the practices aren't at that particular time using them. We found that to be a successful strategy. Previously, when we had financial reports, et cetera, somebody would say, hey, can I have this count of my patients? But it could be defined in a variety of ways, so your count of your patients and your count of your patients could be very different, so you can't really compare those numbers. And then if you go over time, you can't compare them over time either. So it seems to fall apart with that. We define it for everybody, again, according to the measures, and push it out on McKesson's product called HBI, which is our business management tool. So everybody can see the quality metrics. Anybody in our organization could see my rate of the hemoglobin A1C being greater than 9. They could see my practice's rate as well. Where the privacy comes in is at the patient level. So they couldn't see any patient names or exact patient detail, but they could see provider and practice. It's taken us a bit of time to get to the point where we were comfortable with that. Initially, people were a little bit afraid of having data out. Initially, our level of transparency was at the practice level, and it's just really been in the past 6 months that we've been able to push it down to the provider level. So that's something that actually I think we should be really proud of, to be able to get more comfortable using data. So with those issues in mind, and we try also to use measures that people care about. It's interesting that warfarin was mentioned. That's actually one of our most popular operational registries because the safety of warfarin is so significant, or monitoring warfarin in a proactive population way is so helpful. So I was interested to see that was mentioned. So we have a variety of quality measures. I actually listed some of them. We've started almost always with breast cancer screening. Just it's so definable. And anytime we've actually switched EMRs, we've switched our platforms for reporting. Almost anytime we do anything new, we level our learning curve with breast cancer screening, and we level the user's learning curve with that, because we're all just so comfortable with that, and there's not so many variables in that. So one thing that I'd recommend is to pick something which is doable and to kind of get your feet wet in that way. So we also have a number of chronic conditions that we monitor. Diabetes, cardiovascular disease, asthma, and COPD. Prevention, we have actually a preventive care, which has all of the guidelines that are A or B recommendation for preventive care at the appropriate ages, breast cancer screening, influenza, and pediatric immunizations. And then operational safety, I mentioned warfarin, results tracking for certain tests. We found that to be a little bit overwhelming to track all results, so we're actually just specifying what we're tracking for now. Any medication recalls. And we're getting into some medications that are used, for instance, Galenia, used for multiple sclerosis, that has some tricks to it that we're monitoring. We're pulling specific elements that are significant to the use of Galenia, such as you shouldn't be on a beta blocker and Galenia at the same time. So, you know, purposely searching through the records to see, hey, is anybody else put this person on a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker? and then notifying the neurologist of that. We also have some operational priorities. We think it's important to screen for depression in folks that have chronic care, so we allow the practices to choose which chronic condition they're interested in and have a registry of who's been screened for depression and some data elements as well. And then we also think it's important to be able to say, this person needs additional attention, I want them on a registry. So choose people for what we call our care management registry. We've moved recently, so that's kind of where we started and where we've evolved to with quality and operational reports. As we've become more comfortable with the data and views, centricity, electronic health record, a subset of our practice or group uses NextGen electronic health record. We've had some folks on paper, so I think we're all in the same boat where we have data in different spots. And we've built basically our own graphical user interfaces for them to enter data for priority reports for that as well. Once we've gotten comfortable with that, we've actually moved to the hospital system and said, okay, transitions in care is important as well. So give us a list of all the folks that were discharged. We'll match it up with where they go, and we'll provide a discharge reconciliation report so that at the practices, they, the next day, get notification that their patient is discharged and can call the person and reconcile the discharge. We've actually moved that a little further, and now the notification is when they're admitted in case there's any heads up that you want to give to the attending physician. And then we've also worked a bit on access to care. I've found that operational measures such as access, discharge reconciliation, which involves multiple systems, are a little bit trickier, but oftentimes more very rewarding once you get them going. We've, since 2008, which was the first year we've had a CMS certified registry, so we've repurposed the data and sent it to CMS for PQRS, which you can imagine in a group of 750 clinicians has resulted in pretty significant reimbursement for us. So that's probably why I'm here today. it's the truth of the matter. I think it was Mike and I that were the people that raised their hand and said, yeah, we've received reimbursement. That hasn't been our only opportunity, medical home reimbursement. We've had some state collaborative reimbursements as well. And then a number of our insurers do have some quality reimbursement. So CMS certainly has been, at least for us, the forerunner. We've taken all our work with data, we've now moved into some dashboards which aren't particularly the e-measurement focus of this morning, though has been really helpful for us as a physician group. With the dashboard, you go to one place instead of, you know, your financial reports are on SharePoint and maybe your quality reports are on HBI. And your service press gaming results get, you know, emailed to you. So it could be in a variety of spots. So we have managers at 110 different sites all going to different spots and looking at reports in different formats. So what we've done is taken that, put it in one spot and all in the same format so you don't have that learning curve each time you open a report. And that's been something that's been very helpful to us. I've said a lot. I only have one more slide, but is there any questions or anything that I can expand upon?
I have a few questions. That I
sure,
think,
Ken.
So your practice system is its own CMS qualified registry,
yeah,
for PQRS?
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. And in fact, I think it was that AMA meeting that we were at together where I sat next to someone and they said CMS is opening a window to submit for registry.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that was the time.
And do you have a sense how many different measures the physicians in your health system are reporting on? And is it up to them to choose which measures are applicable to their practice?
No, it hasn't been. And really, the we're reporting on, I would say, a total of about 18 measures.
That was 18?
Yeah. Yeah, and I could get that exactly. We seem to have dropped the internet connection, or I at least did. But what we think it's important that you're reporting on measures that are important to you. But I don't know how clinical informatics teams are in other health systems. Ours is very, very small. So at times it was two or three people. Right now it's up to five, which is the most that we've had. So we really couldn't go to even like our AIDS activity office, which is a hugely important office, and say, what measures would you like? I'm sure they would pick HIV-appropriate measures. One, they're only reporting on a subset of their population, only the Medicare population, so it really isn't a full quality measure for them. And two, really they're also seeing diabetes. So we could take internal medicine, family medicine, and endocrinology and report the diabetes measures with many of the medications that are used for HIV, you know, increase the chances of diabetes. So, it, you know, as long as it's perfectly appropriate, then we've used, you know, the same measures for as many as possible.
Okay. Question, are these individual measures, 18 individual ones, or are you doing groups or GPRO or?
We're doing individual measures,
okay.
And you have to be successful
right.
in submitting three.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody gets three. Now, for a while, use of an EHR was a measure.
Right.
You know, so that was kind of a freebie that we could use as a backup, and just in case somebody didn't have too many diabetics or something like that, that happened to have Medicare. You know, OB-GYN, we use mammogram screening, screening for tobacco use, et cetera. So always measures that are appropriate to the specialty, but no, there's no, you can't just go pick.
Marty, what were your challenges? You have different physicians using different vendor systems, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what were your challenges in reconciling the different vendors so that you could implement this quality reporting across the vendor environment?
That is challenging. Actually, the main challenge was just getting data from the systems. Honestly, at the end of the day, once you're accustomed to it, isn't so hard. But making sure that the people are documenting in the spot from which you're getting the data, you have to make sure that you're doing that. So if they didn't have a lab interface and they weren't necessarily putting the hemoglobin A1C value in a spot where we could get it, they were putting it in their note, it didn't seem as fair to them to use that as a measure. So that was, I think, our main difficulty. Or as we're transitioning to the EHR, if you're not putting that data in, you sometimes miss, you know, a little bit. I think that's the biggest challenge. Once you're accustomed to getting the data, the problems. The people on paper, you know, they were motivated to use the GUI interface, and we could get a data dump of labs, so that wasn't so difficult, and then just ask them to enter the data additionally.
So then you guys, from the registry perspective, did all the aggregation based upon the CMS DQRS requirements and submitted the data. Are those same practitioners submitting the underlying QRDA data, in any cases from the EHR directly? Or are you guys, as the data submission vendor, working towards that?
So for the EHR option for PQRS?
Right.
Are any of your practices or within the health system submitting data through the EHR option of PQRS? So there's claims,
no.
There's registry, there's EHR, there's...
Right.
Group practice.
We haven't taken advantage of that now. For meaningful use, we might choose the EHR for that. But, you know, there's a cost associated with that. And then there's the cost also associated with having people to do that in-house.
Yep.
So.
And then can you, so you mentioned about 18 measures that are part of PQRS.
Yes.
It sounds like you're tracking a lot more than 18,
yeah.
You know, across the system. Do you look to... you know, you mentioned the level A and B evidence, but do you look to actual measures that have been endorsed by the NQS? And then when you're implementing those, are you using sort of the specifications that are out there for these national reporting programs when available?
Yes, we're using the specifications. If we're focusing on a chronic condition such as diabetes, and one of the, you know, measures that our folks are interested in is a dilated eye exam and proof of the same. If NQF didn't have a measure for that, I think we would put that in regardless because we're focusing on that chronic condition, but we'll ensure that we have the measures that are important to NQF, PQRS, et cetera.
I think if the goal is automated quality reporting, you know, you just, at the high level, the goal is automated quality reporting, as you said, you need to make sure that you're measuring, you can compare your statistics across different hospitals, cities, you know.
Yeah.
And so that all leads back down to the common
right.
specifications. And so that, you know, I think from one place to another, you could say, yes, we're measuring diabetes, hemoglobin less than 8, but you could probably come up with 20 different ways to specify that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, we stick exactly
to the measure. And every once in a while, there's discrepancies in recommendations or
yes.
measures, and then we get to pick, you know.
So what about meaningful use? Has your health system started to
yes.
participate, or do they plan to, and kind of where are you on that course?
A subset has already submitted for meaningful use, but the larger group has not yet, though probably in the not-too-distant future. We certainly are meeting the requirements of it, so they'll test soon. We will test soon. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Who is your vendor that you are using for your registry?
Us.
You just created it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We have our own register. And I'll tell you, it actually has been great to work with Medicare for that registry. The meetings that we've gone to have all been, this is a patient-centric registry, and it really seems like they're trying to do the right thing, you know, for the patient, so it's really been helpful. Do you want me to tell you what we've learned? And then,
yeah.
But do you have, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is there anyone on the phone with a question or a comment? Is there anyone on the phone?
Okay. Yes, ma'am, we have one participant on the phone.
Hi, who's on the phone with us?
Sir, your line is open. Please go ahead.
John Mays.
Ah, there he is. Welcome. You're one of our track leaders. Thank you. Okay.
Sorry. All right, so what we've learned is that the more natural to the physician's flow or the clinician's flow that the data collection is, the better off we are. And I think fairly fortunately, a lot of the data that's required for the measurement is data that would be coded anyway, blood pressure, labs, chronic conditions, medications, those types of things. So oftentimes we come up across, you know, people want to dictate, et cetera. The more we can allow people to work as naturally as they do, I think the better off we are with just saying, hey, here's the data elements that we really need. If you're going to e-prescribe and do other things, you need that medication list in there anyway. Sometimes you're not the one recording the vital sign, but certainly that should be somewhere where you can get it anyway. So we've had a nice balance in that way. We have the same challenges as I think most other people, exclusions, documenting negatives for contraindications. And I find operational measures to be a little bit more challenging as well. What we've learned also is to choose measures that people care about and to care about the people using the measures. So we have it so that each provider can look at their patient list. So there's no history in where did you get these numbers. And that has helped us a lot as far as getting, number one, buy-in from people, because there's always the that's not my data. That comes up, and I'll tell you, we don't get that as often as we used to. We've really come along, but then they have the opportunity to look at their list and to learn from their list, and so do we, because sometimes they come up with stuff that we either missed or that's important to them to have on the report that may not be part, Kendra, of the, you know, the measure specification. One of the examples that I have, and I think I'd written it, the next visit and last visit from an operational standpoint. Boy, if they're coming in a week, why bother calling them? Why take that time? Or if they haven't come in a year, maybe we ought to call them. You know, that would be very important. So that's a different situation, certainly not something that we need on the measurement, but something that we need operationally to work with the population. I'm just trying to see. The other thing that we've come across is our quality measures oftentimes have a range of patient ages, so say diabetes is 18 to 69, but maybe you have a pretty young 75-year-old and you want to include that person on your registry. We include everybody on the registry, and then the clinician can decide, well, is this person too young or too old? Our quality measures only include the what's specified by the measurement, so that's actually a learning that we've had as well. We've had some issues. Well, we have had lots of issues, actually, but we've had some issues in particular with differences in measurements. So American College of OB-GYN recommends mammograms starting at age 40. U.S. Preventive Service Task Force starts at age 50. The American Cancer Society, they start at age 40. So what we've done for our group measure is go where there's consensus. So everybody agrees 50 and over, you should have a mammogram. So that's our group measure. Now, of course, the registry includes 40-year-olds as well, because there's some people that want 40 and over. And, in fact, the registry also includes measurements for 40. So what was your success at 40? If you follow U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, and that's not where you're going, that's totally okay. But if you're an OB-GYN or a hematologist-oncologist and you think that that is important, then we want to enable you to do what's comfortable for you. So that's how we've come to that, and that seems to be working out pretty well. We've done best when we go for payment that follows practice initiatives. So if it's something that people were interested in and are doing that, then and we repurpose the data for payment, that's worked better than, hey, could you please do this because we'll get paid for it. So that's another learning. And the more transparent, the more consistent we are, and what I heard this morning also, the more patient-centered and the more outcome-based, the more successful we are. I think that was... any other questions at all?
Are any of the measures in your registry outcomes measures or the ALPHOS measures?
Oh, no. ALPHOS, like hemoglobin A1C, let's see, blood pressure measurement. Outcome would, if you have a person, with heart failure on an ACE inhibitor, would you consider that outcome?
That's a process measure.
Yeah.
But I think the intermediate outcome measures, such as blood pressure target, LDL target, hemoglobin A1C target, would be good intermediate outcome measures that I think you're probably tracking.
Yeah, and yes, absolutely. We're also having that conversation with ACCESS. The traditional ACCESS measure from IHI is third next available appointment, which is a measure that's utilized often. What we've come up with is if a person calls in the morning, did they get an appointment that day? I think that's more of an outcome measure, like did you get in or not? Not available for your third next available appointment. So that type of thing, we're trying to focus on that. We haven't really seen many endorsed measures for ACCESS in that regard.
You haven't had to do much for stratification or disease severity with those measures. Are there any other ones you're looking at putting in your registry? We'd have to do the board. With neurology, we have to do a lot of them, which is why I'm asking.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'd like to get to talk to you because that would be interesting. We do risk stratification with diabetes. Quite honestly, we made it up. I guess it's the best. I'm trying to think of better words. But it was basically, is your hemoglobin A1C less than 7, between 7 and 9, greater than 9, you get 0, 1, or 2 points. Blood pressure less than 130 over 80, 140 over 90, that range. Had you been in the hospital, the emergency room, or been readmitted, you get 2 points for that automatically. So we picked five factors that we felt were LDL cholesterol as well, were the most significant and reliable, and stratified based upon that. So we could do something more.
You referenced points. So are those then linked to additional reimbursement or any other payment initiative?
No, honestly, Kendra, that was mostly so that we could target patients that we felt needed the most attention. And we're now actually developing a high-risk registry based upon clinical indicators, how many medications you're on, how many chronic conditions you have, and whether you've been in the emergency room, hospital, been readmitted, or if you're readmitted, you're actually in high risk. So those types of things as well.
To your point about the differences in guidelines and recommendations, obviously that's something that as a measure developer we struggle with a lot, and how do we get consensus on what we're going to put out there as, the recommendations for the measure? And I think you made a very important point that just because the patient falls outside of the age range for the measure doesn't mean that that therapy or treatment or screening is not appropriate for that patient. And so I think that's a very important piece when looking at measurements. You're trying to capture sort of the always must-dos, I guess, is one way to say it, So I think it's nice that your registry has that flexibility to still allow that to be included in that physician sort of.
I don't think we would have gotten much buy-in from users if we didn't, Me, myself,
I'm really impressed with the progress that you've made. I just wanted to hear a little bit more detail about sort of what the clinicians are doing and then what's happening on the back end to get the information into the registry. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about data being naturally collected, there was probably some education that had to go on for the clinicians in terms of what they were documenting and where they were putting it.
Yes.
And maybe you can share with us kind of how that went. And then how is the data getting into the registry? Is a report being generated that's automatically pulling, or is there someone manually running reports and then transferring?
Okay. Yeah. All right. So the first question is, how does the data get in? And if there's like a particular flow, then how do you do that well? Much of the data does get in naturally. So labs, vital signs, medications, and I'm grateful for that, as both as a clinician and as a person that collects the data. There's some that are always a little more difficult, like diabetic foot exam. The eye exam, that's oftentimes done by somebody else, so getting that information and then scanning it into your record in a way that we can pick it up. So really it is basically just saying, here's where you have to put that for us to get it. I've heard Carolyn Clancy speak a number of times and make it easy to do the right thing. It seems to be one of the messages that she's brought out. I think that's really, really important. So the easier it is, the more it's where you're at and there's some value to you. Like the next time you open the chart for that diabetic patient, you know that you did your foot exam, then the more likely it is to happen. The further away it is and the less value it is, the less likely, and there's some we don't get that well, you know. So it was something that takes a long time for us to get. Oftentimes also if you can do it in a team-based environment, we actually trained all of our medical assistants to do diabetic foot exams. Because, you know, we are hoping that we could then improve our compliance with that measure. So there's a number of ways to try that. And what was the second question? Sorry.
Then once the data is in the clinical record, how is it getting into the registry? Is that manual or is that automated?
Okay, and then it's Sheila Teasdale, one of my favorite people. If it moves, automate it. So we do nothing manually. We can't.
I'm not lying. I didn't think you could.
Yeah, there really are just, and there have been at times, like, two of us doing this. So we basically set up the report, we put it in test, we have, you know, people test, make sure it works, and then, you know, just a scheduler, a task scheduler, we run the report automatically each day. The other thing that I don't think I mentioned, historically when you're using data, financial data, et cetera, it seemed like it was okay to have that a month old or so. Clinical data, that won't work. So we actually were fortunate to have work our queries off of a copy of PROD, so we don't interfere as far as speed with PROD, but it's copied each night, so our data is a day old, which works out very nicely for us.
How is the patient initially entered into the registry? Is that automated?
They just meet the criteria. So say I came into your office tomorrow and I had diabetes, the next day I show up on the registry.
Okay, so it's auto-processed.
Yeah. Now some measurements require 2 visits, and some don't. So that's where, and population differences are the hardest because, you know, once you have the population, really, if it's less than 7 or less than 8 or less than 8.4, it's so easy to do. But if you have to change the population, that's harder.
You've got different systems, different EHRs
mm-hmm.
feeding into this central
registry. Yeah.
It's challenging with that, too.
Not that, really, because you just take the code, you know, we share the code, and then apply it to the other system. And then, you know, if you have it formatted in the same way, you can meet them together. I mean, it was work.
This is not my area of expertise, but I hear people saying that that's where they're getting hung up, is that they're in an affiliated health system but using different...
Yeah, actually, this Marty, this is very inspiring, in fact, that you have your own local customized registry. What I'm going to talk about, of course, is a Pinnacle, which is a... professional organization, you know, physician organization developing an ambulatory registry specifically for cardiovascular disease, which is kind of the opposite spectrum because obviously it's designed to work with all these different vendor environments. But I think that what you've been able to do is with structured data fields so that data can be moved and reused, which is important to physician workflow because that's the biggest issue with quality reporting. Physicians really, it has to be part of their normal workflow, and you have to reuse the data for not only workability and usability, but also data quality. Because if you're asking people to re-enter information, it's probably not going to be correct. So data quality goes down. So it's really key. You've done a great job.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Pinnacle's a great registry as well.
So
May I ask one question and then we'll
we'll go to that because I think it'll probably highlight, underscore a lot of things that that Marty touched on.
Okay. So, as you know, quality measure developer, we're when we develop the e-measure for our use in national programs, we are following the recommendations for the different clinical vocabularies that have come out of the Health IT Standards Committee. And my question is, to what extent in your system do you, is your data, have you, are those terminologies incorporated? So is do you use SmellMed in your system? Do you use LOINC for lab results? Or is the problem list still ICD-9, you know, that type of thing?
Our problem list is still ICD-9. I think labs are consistent with the LOINC
I can.
I like to phone a friend.
You gave the right answers.
Oh, good.
So I'm from GE Healthcare, I mentioned before, so we make Centricity EMR, Centricity Practice Solution. ICD-9, currently we're moving to ICD-10, and you know the timeline of that obviously is currently juggling, but it may not affect our timeline. We don't currently do SNOMED, but that's on our longer distance roadmap, and it's clear that we need to meet a lot of the measures, the electronic measures in particular, and LOINC for labs. But that is always a challenge, that the terminologies are not standardized, and EMRs are not all the same. Even, you know, whether it's certified EHR technology or not, underlying data models are very different. I think there tends to be in a lot of the measure developers the assumption, oh, we'll put a SNOMED code and it's, you know, map one-to-one, and it doesn't. And that's particularly in a our EMR is technically structured, but it's highly customizable, as you know, and extensible, and our users often will create their own sort of mini data model within the data model. They'll set up their own what we call observation terms and use their own groups of places to record data, and it doesn't always map one-to-one directly to the e-measures, and that's actually the biggest challenge.
That is a challenge.
Yeah, very big. And if you've built your own reports, then you feel my pain.
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, just because we can specify it using a coded terminology doesn't mean that it's collectible, doesn't mean that it's in the record, doesn't mean that it's captured through clinical workflow. And that's a point of, that's kind of what sometimes keeps me up at night is, okay, are the specifications that we're putting out, sure they adhere to the standard, but can someone actually use them? And so...
I was going to say, and users get very sort of possessive of the workflows that they've created, and they don't want the work. They want the EMR to meet the workflows, not the other way around. But then, if the specifications require a particular workflow, we get sort of stuck in the middle. That, well, why should we have to change our workflow? Well, that's what the measure is. You want, if you want a report that aligns with the measure, you need to follow the workflows. But we don't want to, you know. So it's that sort of, on the one hand, we get that it should be highly structured and that the measure should specify one way for all vendors. But on the other hand, on the customer side, we understand that the customers want something customizable, extensible, and, you know, it's theirs and follows their workflows. And that's, you know, and having been on the other side of the table as a customer in the past, I get that. So that's your challenge.
It's
I guess I was going to just add that. So it sounds like from a general vendor perspective, even though newer measures or contests may require SNOMED or may get spec'd a certain way, it's not nowhere near a plug-and-play where you're taking a list of SNOMED codes, plugging them in, say, like you would with ICD-9, into the system to load them. There's a back-end external-type process that maybe somebody has to program to do the translations.
I'll give you a good example, and this is something we just had a conversation with the PQRS folks about, is that PQRS, going forward, is really aligning very much with CPT codes, and they want patient-level data. So we have a concept of an office visit that is not necessarily 992.14, 992.13, but we know it's an office visit. We don't know which EM level it was because we're not a billing system. And so we understand from CMS that we can sort of just guess, and just if it's an office visit, just put 992.12. We're not billing to that, but it meets their criteria for what's an office visit for measures. But it doesn't map exactly. If they say, you know, we want 992.12 and not 992.13, that's not something that a non-billing system can handle. So that's where we run into trouble.
I think you'll be glad to hear then that at least in our specifications, we're also providing SNOMED concepts for face-to-face interaction.
Right.
And so there's,
I would say you're not as tied to the business meet the requirements of how you have to bill, but maybe
right.
a little more flexibility and say, yes, it was, you know, a visit with the physician, or I sent the patient an email.
We may not map exactly the SNOMED concepts. We may map to what we call document types, so it's a different concept, different data model that's been around for 15 years that just doesn't necessarily match with what you're thinking today.
Yeah.
We're moving in the direction of standardizing along SNOMED lines, but that takes a lot of time.
Now, if you're that issue, we would address as far as is it a 9921 whatever.
Yeah.
Even as far as our Medicare registry, who we bill. You know, so was this a Medicare patient? So if you're not in the billing system, you may not know that.
Right.
We pull our registry from our billing system and then match it up. So there's a little bit of homework.
Right.
So occurs for those folks that, you know, need to do that to fill their.
Not to get too far off in the technical weeds, but the vendors, SNOMED CT, construction of the problem list is a critical element to solving the physician workflow problems, because you can get the clinical granularity that you need to. Heart failure is a great example. You can create then measures around the class of heart failure. You cannot do that with ICD-9 codes. You won't be able to do it with ICD-10 codes. You have to use SNOMED CT in order to get the clinical granularity, particularly for registry work and decision support. And so the more advanced decision support modules will have to be built on SNOMED CT, and actually I think ONC recognizes that. So just since you represent the vendor community, my plea would be move there as fast as possible.
It is recognized among the community as fast as possible. I think those last two words are key, because it's, you know, realize the size of these databases, and if you do anything that requires mapping and terminologies, that's, you know, we're talking here not in weeks or months, we're talking here in
right.
year or years.
Right.
So it's, but it is recognized that it is necessary, especially when it's a heterogeneous system, people using different billing systems, mm-hmm. and you can't just link into it.
Right, right. Or we have the same issue with heart failure, you know, what
yeah.
the New York Heart Association class, and we've basically, again, we took our ProSolve as our echo vendor, and just took all those echo reports and found out what the ejection fraction was, you know, because
right.
so many reports are dependent upon the ejection fraction.
Right.
And if we didn't enter it as data into the EHR, we'd never get that.
So you pulled the report and entered.
So
then we pulled that into our standard population. Everything, and I guess I should state that everything is based upon a standard population. And once you have that, that really just helps out a lot, because then you can just keep hitting it, and you know it's consistent.
We have EF entered as a link. Using LINC as the standard for EF.
Okay, yeah.
So it's actually in a lab data field, which could then be
right.
transferred.
Right. Do you enter that manually, or?
It's actually pulled from the echo report.
See, that's nice. We just haven't been able to quite, you know, get that
sure.
into our EHR, so
yeah.
we just get it into our reporting at least.
Sure.
So I want to raise one other point, which is that, I mean, we're talking a lot about the limitations of the EHR systems and how SNOMED is, but I do think we have to be cognizant of what providers experience and why they may not want to change their workflow. And just always being cognizant that be sure that if you're specifying something that creates a particular process or workflow, that that's actually needed to get the result rather than just the needed to get the information, and whether there can be other ways of getting that information. So one concern that I always have is that we force a particular pathway in activity through measurement. And there may be other ones that are more effective. And also just always making sure that, if possible, much flexibility in that process to keep things aligned, and I think that goes a long way for me to being able to get doctors to actually implement the measures. So if they think, well, I know I'm doing this, I have a good adherence to my hemoglobin A1C levels and my diabetic patients, but this measure is slightly different and so much of a pain to calculate, I'm just not going to do it. So you have to be just try to think through that process, because it is a coaching process with the doctors, and it is making sure that it's not the measure that we're trying to force and it's the result that we're trying to force.
I think that's a great point, and I think that we bump into that all the time. Just because the foot exam isn't documented doesn't actually mean it wasn't done. So I come up with a performance rate of 20%, and I look like a loser, but the truth of the matter might be that we have our foot exam documentation, you know, in a place which is difficult to get to, and, you know, I just don't get there, and maybe for reasonable reasons, you know. There's only so many places you can go.
Okay.
Well, let's turn to Dr.
So if you're following slide number 12, monitoring performance of atrial fib management using the Pinnacle Registry, and just a little background, this is going to be a vignette of a specific case use of a registry for reporting on a quality measure surrounding a chronic disease, atrial fibrillation. So I'm in a big cardiology group that was purchased by Parkview Health System. Parkview Health is a large system in northeast Indiana. And the group, employed physician group, PPG, there's over 300 physicians. The cardiology group is the only group that actually is utilizing the Pinnacle Registry right now, and we use it internally for bonus compensation. We have a bonus compensation formula based on the physician performance. So slide number 14 is my disclosure. I've been involved with American College of Cardiology Informatics for many years, sit on the NCDR, which is National Cardiovascular Data Registry Management Board, which is which really is the pinnacle, sits underneath that, but also they have hospital-based registry reporting. And I also am involved with leadership at Heart Rhythm Society and a bunch of other things. So just to move on, slide 15. So the National Cardiovascular Data Registry is extensive quality data, primarily hospital-based, was really evolved around PCI and ACTION Registry, which is a KIDMI registry, ICD Registry, which is mandated by Medicare, and the CARE Registry, which is carotid stenting. So these registries were developed, surrounding hospital payment, really. The ICD Registry is a good example. And the quality measures, to some degree, or outside the scope of what we want to talk here today. We really want to talk about the ambulatory setting, and Pinnacle was the first ambulatory registry designed to capture quality measures surrounding the management of coronary disease, hypertension, atrial fibrillation, and congestive heart failure. And the measures that are utilized in this registry are NQF-endorsed measures, and as much as possible, PCPI endorsed, and Kindra and I've had some conversations about that. That ACC's tried to harmonize and work with AMA and make sure that there's harmonization across specialties, primary care, as much as possible, so that there's not a mismatch, which is an important item, particularly when talking about national registry. So any of you representing professional organizations, as you go down this registry path, first starting point, of course, is to speak with AMA, I think, and see what they're doing in that space where you have common measures. So what we're going to talk about a very specific case use, and why should we do this? We wanted to measure document quality for our referring physicians, our patients, the employer, the health system, and the private payers. We do created a cardiology incentive plan surrounding the use of the registry. We wanted to demonstrate individual adherence to guidelines and identify areas for improvement and provide the clinical decision support tools at the point of care. Just kind of background, our group was developed, you know, for a number of years. I've been in practice for 30 years with this group. I'm one of five electrophysiologists in the group, so we tend to be technically oriented people, so that's why I'm attracted to health IT. We've had an electronic health record since 1999. We use a product called WebChart, which is medical informatics engineering, which we've actually helped the vendor develop interfaces for the hospital, developed decision support tools, and so we've been involved with quality reporting for some time. Next slide, just a picture of the new Heart Institute they just moved us into after they bought our practice, which is very nice. And we're switching over to Epic at the hospital enterprise system in this summer. So we started off this project with five physicians. We have a cardiology quality committee. It focused on quality reporting. We first started enrolling patients in the Pinnacle Registry in 2009. didn't roll out to the entire group, so I'm getting down to write the details of reporting. We report not only at our main office, which is in Allen County, but also our outlying clinics. We have 12 outlying clinics. So this is a slide 20, shows you a typical Pinnacle report. This is an early report of the physicians that just started reporting at the beginning. And the measure, Pinnacle measure 54, is chronic anticoagulation prescription for warfarin for patients with non-valvular AFib. So you can see there's a very high level of compliance with that particular measure. Shown here is Pinnacle measure 66, which is chronic assessment of thromboembolic risk, which is very important. And you can see here our performance, which is in red based on the bottom there, which is at that time, which is 2009, the performance from the registry nationally. So these are the kind of reports that the practice was receiving at that time. Next slide, 22, Pinnacle chronic anticoagulation therapy, same thing, our practice performance versus the national average. Practice performance was at that time in the range of 97 to 98% as opposed to the registry. So we were pleased with this. Well, I'm going to go over the reason why we had such high achievement even at that point. So one of the key things with regards to workflow on slide 23 is this is, I'm going to show you some screenshots. So Pinnacle was developed by the ACC initially, which was against my recommendation. They allowed paper-based data entry back in 2008, which right immediately got a bunch of practices off track. But we felt that, you know, really they wanted to get going, and again, these data fields that are in the registry were based on NQF-endorsed measures. This system now we use for PQRS incentive program, so we're able to utilize the registry to get the incentives for that. But anyway, make a long story short, quickly now it no longer allows analog data entry. You have to use either a vendor that will directly submit the data, or they will utilize a data aggregator called FIGMD, which I know the ophthalmology optometry community uses this a lot, which is basically will go into your EHR and passively pull the data out of your electronic record and then submit it electronically on your behalf. Shown here is a data field. So what fundamentally happens, as I mentioned, is many of these data fields are auto-populated, the demographics. The problem list, so the physician becomes a data editor. The problem list will be auto-populated based on the SNOMED CT problem list that's constructed in the chart. Shown here is a data field, next to slide 24, showing you a patient that has atrial fibrillation, and again, I want to stress the importance of SNOMED CT. It will allow us to quantify or, you know, put into a bucket a paroxysmal atrial fib versus persistent atrial fib or permanent atrial fib, which is a data field that is in Pinnacle. It's a structured data field. And again, I want to stress that these data fields are harmonized across different registries so that exactly the ICD registry ultimately will be linked to the Pinnacle registry so that the data fields are linked so that you get longitudinal data for some of these inpatient registries, which is important. And it shows what a physician would see as it proposed to anticoagulation with this particular measure. So I'm just showing you the atrial fib part of this. When a physician sees a patient, they're going to be filling this out for, I mean, basically looking at the fields for coronary disease, congestive heart failure, atrial fib, and hypertension. So AFib, again, this just shows you the granularity there. This is all, so the physician becomes an editor. And, of course, what this is doing is collecting the CHADS. This on slide 26, the next slide, it shows you what can come out of the registry. On slide 26 is the CHADS score calculation. It's basically calculating a CHADS score, which are these risk factors for thromboembolic risk. So shown here, I'm going to show you some recent data. So in 2011 now, we're all the physicians are on board. We started off as far as incentivizing physician participation. I wanted to kind of underscore some of the things that Marty said. Number one, I've de-identified this so you can't see. These are individual physicians. So if a physician didn't participate, so first of all, the first year we rolled this out, the physicians just had to participate 50% of the time to receive their incentive compensation. Next year, 80%. And now we're focused on intermediate outcomes. They have to not just participate, but we're focusing on blood pressure control is a specific outcome. So we're focusing on a specific intermediate outcome. But shown here is the physician adherence for this measure, Pinnacle 54, chronic anticoagulation, third quarter of 2011, recent data. And you can show here assessment of Pinnacle measure 66 for thrombotic risk, adherence versus the Pinnacle registry nationally. Shown here is chronic anticoagulation therapy prescribed, warfarin prescribed, again, practice versus the national registry, which is now up to 60%, which is better. So this is data specifically for me as a physician, individual physician, that we actually do not, and I think underscoring one of the important things that Marty brought out is transparency. So slide 30 shows the actual data for myself, but we actually show that to our group in a group meeting. We have a quality component to any group physician meeting where we go over the quality data, and shown here is my numbers from 2009, 2010, 2011. So what is really important, which is a landscape for those of you from professional societies, so there's an article published by Paul Chan using this Pinnacle Registry looking at practice variation warfarin use for patients, and slide 32 shows you that variation. And you say, wow, this is pretty dramatic, you know, and the fact that really the median rate is only 61%, which is not good. And then there was a big trial called Improve HF, slide 33, where this was a trial that was NIH-sponsored and also sponsored by some vendors looking at heart failure management. And part of that trial, slide 34, it looked at, it went into chart audits on 35,000 patient charts. And over 80% of these practices were community practice, not academic practices. And so really important because it shows that they went in and looked at the management of heart failure. And then slide 35 shows you the results. And what this trial did, they went in and repetitively did chart audits and looked at improvement based on rolling out tools to improve on process measures such as ACE inhibitor use, beta blocker use, aldosterone antagonist use, CRT, which is resynchronization therapy for heart failure, ICD use, heart failure education. And you can see the one thing that really didn't change was anticoagulation for atrial fib, which is pretty discouraging. And it's like static at 69% throughout the trial. And I think it shows you the lack of use of electronic clinical decision support. Because the vast majority of these practices, the tool that was used was just these analog, you know, education things that they're giving doctors and the practices. And so so what this made us think, you know, we're doing something different. So what are we doing in PPG cardiology for atrial fibrillation? Well, I think what I was alluding to, active versus passive data extraction. If you're reporting data to a system that you have a data aggregator coming in and just pulling it out, you get quarterly reports, the patient's already gone. You want to have a system that at the point of care, the quality measures captured, identical to what Marty was alluding to, the physician and team, nurse, physician, medical assistant team, then have an opportunity to say, hey, you know, for some reason this patient is not on warfarin anticoagulation. What happened? You know, so you can change. It becomes decision support. We had a focus on atrial fibrillation management because of, I think, the EP group, and we created an infrastructure to address quality issues. So I think slide 37, active versus point-of-care data entry is very important. The physician at that point, the exceptions are very important to identify and document. So physician identifies contraindication anticoagulation. So you'll get credit for that in the registry if you document that. And also, of course, the point of care aspect of this really is a poor man's decision support tool. Slide 38, one other cultural thing. We developed decision support tools back in 2002 using computer order entry. It's at the ambulatory level. We had a grant to do that for heart failure and atrial fib. And we did combine that with medical students doing manual audits of our atrial fibrillation management to validate our decision support. And then we created a quality committee. And then the last thing is, because of all this, we created infrastructure, which I'm sure, for example, in Allentown, Marty's got this in slide 39, the kind of infrastructure behind the electronic tools, anticoagulation therapy clinics, system-wide anticoagulation protocols, anticoagulation nurses, warfarin nurses, who are also now also utilizing and monitoring the use of the non-warfarin anticoagulation for non-valvular atrial fib, and nurse practitioners have been extremely important in the success of our infrastructure. So in summary, this last slide for you, this is a very specific case use of how we utilize this platform for quality reporting, and then by giving very specific, physician-specific reports on a quarterly basis, improved quality. I just chose atrial fib for a demo. Areas where we need improvement, coronary disease management, referral to cardiac rehab has been a real problem for the cardiologists. I think the interventional cardiologists currently are the old cardiovascular surgeons. Their behaviors, you know, the patient gets a stent and they don't think they need anything after that, which is, you know, I make a long story short, you know, we never cure anybody of coronary disease. So, you know, those measures, that's what we're tracking real closely. Why are we not having physician buy-in? Because that's one of the quality measures that is collected for coronary disease, is referral to cardiac rehab after an intervention. And so we're tracking that very closely to try to improve. And I think it's the point of care electronic data entry that's important, and having your vendor help you with decision support tools, that will help. So that's it. So I showed you really good stuff, but I should show you the bad stuff. So we're not that good. And all physicians think they're better than they really are. That's the other thing. Is the transparency is important. You know, everybody thinks they're doing a great job, and then you send a report, and they go, well, this can't be right. There must be something wrong. And, you know, say, well, you know, particularly, and Marty had some great examples where if you can enter the data and in a structured data field, and so the data then is reused, there's really, you've minimized the errors, and it's the data is the data. And so documenting the exceptions is always a challenge, which is usually the reason most physicians kind of fall down on quality reporting is the physician is not documenting the exception and rule, or the vendor solution isn't created in such a way that that's done easily. Okay, hopefully that's helpful.
That's great. Why don't we take the next 10 minutes or so for questions, discussions, and then we're going to break to pick up lunch, phone call, bathroom break, and come back about 12:15, 12:20.
And actually, they're bringing the lunches down to us since we're farther removed from the rest of the group.
I'm wondering, I have a question.
Sure.
If, can you think of an example where the data collection did not fit with your workflow?
Oh, yeah.
And how was that actually, like, what did you do to talk through, you know, is it the data cast that you changed with the workflow? Is it, you know?
So, this is a great question. Actually, that's the heart of the question. So what the quality group, that's one of the reasons we only rolled it out. This is it for all of you, and I'm sure Marty had the same experience. You want to beta test this with a group of committed people that really understand the challenges of data entry and workflow. And so that's the reason when we initially started a couple years ago, 2009, is we had like a group of physicians who are committed to the quality process, then would work with our vendor and saying, you know, we really need to have this system only ask questions when it's really needed at the point of care, so that it really would not interrupt the physician workflow more than about 30 seconds. And we actually followed the clicks if it required so many clicks, five or more, it's too much. So we really actually, and that's actually a great usability metric, I think, is if you're requiring physicians to start filling out data fields, even point and click is too much. You definitely do not want them to do data entry, because that'll be a disaster. So we generally rely on our nurses, in like the blood pressure measurement is put in, and then it's in a data field, for example. And so what we found, just to answer your question directly, Kendra, was that we worked with our vendor and said, you know, this is how we want you to auto-populate these data fields. This was how we would like you to reuse the data so that when patients come back, everything's already filled out because it's in a structured data field, and that the physician is asked to be a data editor, not a data entry person. And it took probably a year of working with the vendor. Now, this vendor has been able to do it. NextGen has done a really good job, same thing. And so I've been involved at the ACC, at the professional society level, in working with different vendors who are interested in doing this in a workflow sensitive fashion. I mean, there are definitely, and that's one of the problems I believe with the entire ATCB certification process, is it's more function oriented and focused, so that you can perform the function, but it really doesn't care about workflow and usability. And so that all of a sudden physicians are using products that, you know, they're certainly certified and they'll probably be able to satisfy meaningful use, but they won't be able to see any patients. So I think with like this product, this solution, we're in the process of testing for meaningful use, because last year, of course, the e-prescribing program was out of sync with meaningful use, and so we got our e-prescribing incentives maximum, and then this year we're testing for meaningful use. So I don't know if that answered your question, but it does take a lot of commitment to working with your vendor, and if there are problems with workflow, just to see if you can get involved with them either at the local level or nationally. I'm on a work group with Epic now to look at their cardiology functionality, and we've met regularly with their software developers to solve some of their problems. I know everybody thinks they don't have any problems. So I don't have to answer your question.
A question in terms of some of the newer concepts as far as I was talking about, and some of the, you know, whether it's ADE or whether it's some of the functional status assessment, patient-reported outcomes. Have either of you guys started to use, and I guess in your case maybe more specific to CHF, patient-reported data or pilots or anything along those lines?
So that's a great, that launches into, so I'm part of a Beacon Challenge grant to Indiana to use personal health records, EPs, and specifically data information, bidirectional exchange of data between patients around the state. And so at our site, I also specifically have a grant to utilize a PHR to look at the outcomes of patients who are receiving coronary revascularization, either a stent or coronary bypass surgery, and to follow those patients to see if their outcomes are improved over patients who do not have a PHR. So we have to demonstrate bidirectional messaging between the patient. Typically, we focus on blood pressure. They have patients electronically send us blood pressures, and then we send information back to them on you know, what we want them to do. We haven't started this yet, but we're looking to use SureScripts to figure out a methodology to document patient medication adherence by looking at their, you know, prescription refills electronically. So we want to, you know, but our grant is really focused on just demoing bidirectional information exchange, but we actually specifically at our site, because there are seven sites that I'm coordinating, are looking at the intermediate outcomes of these patients who have coronary revascularization, specifically blood pressure target, hemoglobin A1C, and LDL target. So to see if the patients who use a PHR have better engagement, and we have a patient engagement tool that they have to fill out at the beginning and the end. I could email you all a slide deck on that if you want, just for interest, if there's comments, because it's early work. There's no science behind PHR use. Even though it's in meaningful use phase 2, no one has demonstrated that if you use, get patients who use this PHR tool, that they actually do better. And that, I would think, would be an important thing to do early, because then nobody's using PHRs. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me, because we all electronically bank. So why do patients, if they're electronically, if they're using, and that's one of our questions to them, do you do electronic banking? If they do electronic banking, why wouldn't you want to do the same thing with your healthcare? But anyway, there's maybe more information than you wanted, but
no, that's a good answer. That's good.
Yeah, I think as the professional societies are pushing back on the certainly the phase two meaningful use proposal, that I think it's 10% of patients you need to sign them up. So all of a sudden you're responsible.
They have to download the information.
Yeah, exactly. The patients have to use it, really, essentially.
I think basically they have to use it, actually, don't they?
Yeah, they have to. They actually have to download their medical record. 10% of your patients have to download their medical record. So it's not even just that they've come in and looked at something. It's that they're doing something with it, which can be a challenge.
Yeah, so I don't think exactly. We have a grant, so we have research nurses helping rural patients and teaching them how to utilize the PHR. But this is all of a sudden for a big multi-specialty practice, you're going to have to hire people to actually achieve that phase two meaningful. You're going to have to hire a bunch of infrastructure to train people to do this stuff. Unless it becomes so easy to use and intuitive that it would be like, again, electronic banking. If you think, you know, people want to do it because they don't want to go to a bank and, you know, and call anybody, and it's perfect. But for some reason, we're not there yet. I think it may be vendor again.
Yeah, we're not there. I don't use the PHR, so to speak, as you do, or receive data electronically. I think the endocrinologist receives some blood sugar log, but I don't think it's electronic. I think it's over the electronic medium. We get that as well as family physicians. We do use the patient portal, which in Centricity is called Connect, and NextGen, I just can't remember the name, but they have one as well. But it has been difficult for adoption in part because of it's just for us in our system, the way we've adopted it, a little clunky. So we do definitely encourage people. We've even started an e-visit pilot, which, you know, I think it's very cool, but we have to make it easier for the patients to do that too.
Right, yeah. So I think that's a big area that, as we talk about quality improvement and patient-centered quality measures, you know, how are we going to – we don't have the infrastructure that's functioning to a level that needs to be in place to have these – you know, we can develop the measures, just what Kendra said. And what it's going to be there, and we're not going to really be able to collect it because we have to figure out how to enhance patient engagement electronically.
That's, I think, an important point that I kept thinking of while Farzad was talking, is it's kind of the chicken and the egg. You know, we know where we want to be. How do we build it to get there, but yet still function where we are today?
Yeah, with handheld, I mean, there's so many ways now that
right.
People can interoperable everything. There's a ton of things that come into play. I know there are some standardized tools that are being used to capture functional status assessment and whatnot, but it's, you know, things are going to have to be validated. You just can't, you know, do it any old way. So there's lots of challenges.
It's so valuable because that really functional status is, you know, is such a valuable aspect of, you know, a person. A lot of, I know Centricity, and correct me if I'm wrong, if we don't have it turned on yet, but they interface with Instant Medical History, which is a patient interview software, and if you think about it, the patient's the least expensive and most reliable person to enter their data. So, you know, to be able to get that would be so valuable.
So the key, that's actually good. So one of the key, from a vendor perspective standpoint, we have a system, the PHR that we use interfaces with our EHR. But when patients send that, the data has to be validated by the patient's data entry cannot just go directly into the EHR. There has to be a firewall there because they put some crazy stuff in, you know.
I think that's the same with ours, although.
Two grams of metoprolol a day or something, you know.
Like
that, some crazy medication thing. So we've created this firewall, which has, you know, the physician has or nurse will actually see that the patient pushed this data, and then we let it in the record.
It's not just patient data. If you get data from another healthcare professional or through an HIE, you get crazy stuff that way too. So it has to be validated before it goes in. Even if from a medical device, if you get information, it can be validated because EMRs still are not medical devices.
So I do know a little bit. Because I'm kind of geeked out on this stuff. So there's an organization called Integrating Healthcare Enterprise, which I'm sure you're aware of, IHE. So IHE is an international organization on working with vendors. It's not just EHR vendors, but medical device vendors to transfer data in and out of devices. So Heart Rhythm Society, we have what's called an IDCO profile, implantable device cardiac observation. It's a standard that's been developed and actually it's been accepted by IEEE, which is an engineering group, and in all this IHE. It's basically it's a standardized way of exporting data out of like an implantable defibrillator directly into an EHR.
You still have to have some human validated this information, because otherwise, if it's a device, you can have it without validation, but if it's device to non-device, somebody has to say, yes, right.
So we need to go into it. I agree with that, just to make sure that the reason this is really important is because for two reasons. One, physicians are asked to fill out data fields. The ICD registry is a good example. So we want to make sure that the physician just becomes an editor, then these data fields are filled out. The third thing is we have patient consumer groups that want downloads of their implantable device. They want, like, a summary of what's in their device. Believe it or not, it's great up to a point. I mean, for example, there's some patient who happens to be an attorney in Chicago who's suing Medtronic because she wants, like, everything that's in the device. She wants their source code. You know, anyway, like, long story short, it's like crazy. But so there, I think the professional organizations, not to get off on this device thing, but need to have a very active role in this area, kind of creating, you know, some adoption of standards, and so that we don't have, as a vendor, you would say, well, it's great because then everybody's playing with the same rules. We need these standards.
And I think, I mean, from a validation perspective, no matter what the data is, patient reported or otherwise, look at your registries. If you're a PQRS registry and you're sending aggregate data in, CMS is looking at denominator counts through claims and sort of doing comparisons, and lots of things don't match because of a number of reasons right over the first few years.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's all part of the load process and the edits that are built and embedded up front, and not just, like you guys are saying, throw the data in and then worry about it at the back end, you know, at the time you're going to do measurement or whatnot.
So one thing that Marty brought up, which I was interested in, is an operational measure on patients returning. You know, I think you mentioned, like, patients who had a certain disease. You looked at office returns, or if they didn't return. So
yeah, we haven't looked. Oh, well, we look at last visit date, next visit date.
Yeah.
On any of the measures, you can look and see and sort by who hasn't been in that event in order to facilitate proactive population management.
Did you do through your practice management, your claims, was it practice management system driven?
No, we use the EHR for that.
Okay.
You can denote an office visit.
Okay.
By just an arrived visit.
So
it's not a specific.
I think as a quality measure, that's a real important area. For example, after an MI, after a heart attack, we actually, with the ACC, we tried to develop a tool, electronic tool for all cardiologists using just their practice management systems. And we surveyed like 5 practices and used this electronic tool, which just went into their practice management system. If you had an MI, then what was your next office? And
that's
like
a great idea.
30 or 40% of the time, patients never came back. I mean, I can't imagine they had a heart attack and they never came back within a year. I mean, it was just like
maybe they all died.
Hopefully they don't all die. But, you'd say, well, wow, this is pretty bad that they were lost. It would be like an oncology patient being lost. I mean, so you say, well, they didn't come back, or like a stroke patient, same thing. You'd say, well, this is really an important operational issue that electronically we should be able to solve working with a vendor solution.
They go somewhere.
Yeah.
And are we liable to make sure that they ended up somewhere?
Yeah, that's a great question. Another answer, but I just mentioned the Galenia highlight that we've been working on for neurology. We have, you're supposed to have liver function tests at a particular frequency. Are you due for that? You know, when was your last visit? You're supposed to visit every, I don't know, I think it's 3 months. are you due for that?
Right.
And then we just set up a flag if they're due for anything, because it would be monotonous to look at each of the fields. So, yeah, that's same. Interesting that we're doing it in Colonial, not heart attacks.
Yeah, you should do it for heart attacks.
Yeah, we probably should, yeah.
I would add, I wasn't going for a lap just then. I was really, one of the biggest limitations that we find is that we don't have a complete picture of the patient. We have a picture of the patient as she's seen in that particular practice at that moment, you know, in that particular EMR and whatever, perhaps if there's some links with others. And the absurd end of that is death. And we don't get death recorded very often in the charts. The patients just stop coming. And somebody may follow up and may mark a patient. We have a function where you can mark a patient as, you know, as deceased. But it's almost never used because it's just someone might be clearing out claims records or something and might mark it. But it's rare that a patient actually dies in the office. And so you just don't know that. And it's the same thing. A patient may have gone for all the appropriate follow-up tests at another practice, and unless that information is recorded in that particular EMR somehow, you don't know about it. So the quality measure may have been met, just not in that EHR, and so you don't get credit for it.
Right.
That's a big limitation in the technology. Until we're all connected through HIE, however, that's a big piece that we're missing.
So that, I think, we'll be sure to highlight on our report out as a gap area. That really impacts.
So
one way think about that from that's a common sense one, but it's a no-brainer. You would think, come on, how are we not capturing that?
Conclusion. You don't get your mammogram when you're 52 if you died when you were 51. But if you, let's say that you were seen when you were 51, you got, you know, you in Washington, and then you went for a year and you lived in Boston, and you had your mammogram there. When you come back, it looks like you didn't have that mammogram that you should have had.
Right.
When actually, the doctor said you need a mammogram. Oh no, I took care of it. That's the end of it. Now, maybe the doctor can record that in the EHR, but it doesn't always happen. So if everything's going to be automated, it's not like it just could just look, did the patient have the mammogram? Yeah, the mammogram was had, and it's probably in the narrative, which sometimes we can mine for keywords, but usually we don't because there's PHI, you know, issues and so on. And that's really where a lot of these measures fall apart, is that we like to think that every patient has a medical home, but most don't yet. And a lot of people, it's a very mobile society, and move around and doctor shop and their insurance changes.
So is there a way to use a Social Security death index? So all the, you know, so in other words, from a vendor's side, if you could, you know, let's say you're providing, you know, operational support for a practice, you say, well, we're going to query that index.
You can do that to clean out the records, sure. We happen to run our quality reports off the de-identified database.
Oh, okay.
So we can't, but it can be done at the EHR level where you can run a tool that can clean out your records and mark the patients as deceased if, you know, if they come up, although those are sometimes wrong, the registries, but at any rate, it's not just death, it's just the moving around and having two doctors or five doctors or being in another city, mm-hmm. or going to a mammography center that doesn't report back to it commonly, and so it's just, you know, mammogram done, but you don't have the records.
You're getting to the fundamental issue, right, of just even the death piece of this, and now we're talking about how do we get to closing the referral loop.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
You put it in perspective, and you're kind of like, well, that should be easy, but,
because
I mean,
you're able to refer the patient sometimes, but at least, you know, you're talking this day and age of everybody with, you know, their own computer in their pocket. Patients refer themselves, so, yeah, I know I need a mammogram, I'll go get it, and I don't need to tell my doctor or my PCP because, you know, I just go to my PCP for my flu shot, and I'm taking responsibility for my own health care, so I keep track of when I have everything, but then that's not going to come up when you run these measures electronically, and that's been one of our biggest challenges, and I'm sure you...
We have to, well, two, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that what you're talking about, the very long-term goal of, there are many data sources out there,
mm-hmm.
like the death registry,
mm-hmm.
Medicare as a payer, and
mm-hmm.
administrative data, patients do change insurers, but once they hit 65, excuse me, if Medicare is their primary payer, there are claims triggers that can say that mammogram took place in a different state. You know, I don't know what the variability is in terms of, you know, payer change, but thinking long-term towards the future, where are all these pockets of data, and beyond just health information exchanges, what else can we work towards integrating and
yeah.
having at least flags and triggers so that we know, you know, right now I'm doing these chart reviews, and the chart just stopped. Did the patient die? Did they move somewhere else? Did they stop their chemo because of toxicity? Did they run away? Where did they go? You can't talk.
Well, but the challenge is, on a global perspective, that's right. But you also have to think of the practice perspective. what is it, the practice's responsibility to identify those people's or all of those different data sources. If I'm working with a 1-to-3-dot practice, which is what I generally concentrate with, I can't get them to go out and try to find a death registry or do any of that just to try to do quality reporting.
Yeah, it's not realistic.
I mean, we have to figure out a measure that accounts for it. And even if we get into a perfect system where you can go out and search all of those different sources, you still have to have a mechanism to reconcile, is that information right? That's not a fast task, and you can't expect all of this to be non-compensated or processed. I mean, it's far more complicated than just saying, we want this measure. I mean, you
it's
have to be
fast,
realistic.
It's not feasible right now, but unless we as the clinicians and users and developers say what we want to get to, no vendor is going to know what to work towards. So I hear everything that you're saying, but can't right now, that's not feasible, and it's too burdensome. And all.
Well, but I think you always, when you're looking at measures, you can say a target measure, and this is the goal of what we're trying to get to, but you have to design the existing status into kind of the reality.
It's interesting to hear sort of these parallel processes of the measurement perspective, the clinical decision support perspective, the EHR perspective, and all of those integrating at the same time. You know, we all have different, some of us have multiple hats on here. So we want one system that does all these things for us, but then there's people who have a measurement perspective or a vendor perspective, not to say you can't wear more than one hat. But, you know, we want one thing as a clinician. I'm a nurse practitioner. I want one thing that does all of this for me and doesn't give me a warning every 5 seconds that I have to hit ignore because it's getting in the way of what I want to do, but I still want to capture my quality data. We have a long way to go.
The death index has, I think, that it brings out just very poignantly a significant point because there's two things. One is as you use the database at a practice level or at an individual level, the more you use it, the better it becomes. So I would say that a stagnant database is probably the one you don't want to use, the one that you've used a lot is going to have better quality information. That said, if you use programs such as like Vitel that makes those automated phone calls, outreach to patients for proactive population management, boy, it's nice to not call people that have died. I mean,
that's always embarrassing.
Yes, oncology.
But when you do stuff like that, although you start to say, okay, what do we need? What are our needs? And a little bit better, you can define them a little bit better as you at least try to use the information.
We'll stop there.
Okay.
We need
to break for lunch. We've got about 15 to 20 minutes. For those of you that audit lunches, they're here. There's some logistics to it that Shane can help us figure out. The bathroom keys are here and the bathrooms on this floor if you need to make phone calls or whatever. We'll reconvene here at 12:30-ish. If you did not order lunch and you need to run out and get something, we've got a map of restaurants that are in proximity.
Going out.
And both
highlight
thank you all anyway.
That I think is tough in terms of strength of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And then
the cath lab.
Right, exactly.
That's an exercise.
Wow.
And then let's get more out here by year here. So we'll get basically craft. Okay, so it's the same thing. And then we say, well, there's females on this side. Oh, males on this side. There's females on this side. You know, so you can do whatever you want.
Can you do, Yeah,
I'm
going to
look at the
program. Yeah, I'm going to look at the clinician.
My interest was in actually.
Wow.
The oncologist should be a, that'll be a challenge. I know the oncology locally. If patients, some patients take off and go
to the place. Yeah, I'm interested. I'm going to email you about the, the grant, the PHR grant that you're talking about. It sounds like it's not going to be a good trial.
I've been there all these years now. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Do a lot of chemotherapy and targeted agents.
Do a lot of
patients and self-administered and tracking that and their toxicities, which is one of the common reasons that they stop taking it.
Are you here with you again?
Uh-huh. And they've also got grants from Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation to be a fund of fundraising for so I'll be doing a little bit on that too.
Oh yeah?
Plus like a little bit of data stuff. Ad hoc research.
Are the best practice examples related to the development and implementation of e-measures, and those can result from processes, workflows around the specific products that they're using, code systems, or the way they structure data to capture it, or the culture of the organization. Are there mechanisms to enhance data and workflow that we utilize that we want to call out? And three, are there recommendations actually
two also should include gaps that we, because we've commented on a couple of them, but capture those in a methodical kind of way. And then lastly, capture recommendations of things that should be noted or addressed to carry implementation work forward in an office-based environment. So those are the deliverables that we need to come away from. And what Kendra and I thought we could do is take the next 30 minutes or so to continue our general discussion, because that was very rich sharing. It was going back and forth. And then pull back and go through very methodically each of these questions and capture points that we think are important to share with the group. Sound reasonable? Go ahead. Let me first ask, do we have anybody on the phone at this point?
Dr. Macy, are you still there?
Okay, then I think it's just us.
Okay.
So when we left off, we were talking about the gap in how do you really know if a patient stops coming to your practice, how do you know that they're being seen somewhere? How do you know they're having either side, speech, the doctor's, So I don't know if anyone had any additional thoughts they wanted to pass on to that discussion. I mean, we highlighted some of the, I think one of the issues is how is this best tracked? And, you know, there's resource issues with tracking that, you know, across the system. So it's not necessarily just saying it needs to be the physician's practice, because, you know, a bigger issue than that. More of, I think, a true system issue. I don't know if we want to continue that discussion, or if anyone has other topics they
want to
bring up.
I think that's a great discussion. And I think you had mentioned also is, and I guess the corollary is, and how much are we responsible to track that? Maybe like sometimes people just don't want to go to you and they don't really want you to call them, and then they have to tell you that they don't want to go to you, and, you know?
Right.
Maybe they made a conscious decision, you know?
So how,
and that's what we've, with results tracking, which I think is a great idea, we've really had trouble getting our arms around that, because so many labs, diagnostics, and referrals are ordered that if you attempt to, we couldn't attempt to track everything, and we didn't even have parameters on, like, what was vital to track. So what are our priorities? Do you think we have to track things? What are the priorities? What do you do first? And then the physician also has to enter, say, I'd like you to get your mammogram in, you know, next August,
because that's when you're due.
But I order one because that's
when I see you.
That could, unless I say it's not till August, to put that in a trackable field, that'll come up soon as being due. So you have to do more work if you want it to happen properly.
Marty, is this part of a guideline that if you get a mammogram like at age 50, you're supposed to get it annually?
The guideline, I think, says 1 to 2 years.
Yeah.
It says varying things, which is what we had talked about before, but
so
the most lenient is 2 years.
Yeah, it would seem like if you could whatever come up with part of a guideline. I mean, for example, in cardiovascular care, there is no guideline on when you're supposed to have heart failure patients return. That's not in part of the guideline. There's no one that's ever studied it. Although we know that if you're seen more often, you have better outcomes. Same thing with post-MI. There's, again, the same phenomena. Patients that are seen more often have better outcomes, but there's no, like, it's not in a guideline that you need to come back this month, you need to come back in 12 months. So, you know, the key is you have to kind of just make up your own.
And I'll just actually jump on that soapbox for a second as a measure developer, because when we look at developing the measure, we say, okay, what do the guidelines support? And we're very hesitant to actually put for something that is not supported by the evidence.
And then there's evidence-based guidelines and consensus guidelines, and people will push back in terms of that's a consensus guideline, I don't need to follow that, so there's, you know, hierarchy of evidence as well, which complicates things.
And then there's also areas
where you probably wouldn't ever have a true clinical guidelines like some of the patient safety areas, safety recommendation areas. And to us now, at least, have an approach of how to evaluate the type of evidence that a measure is based on when it's not your true grade A, you know, so.
Yeah.
So.
Part of the challenge is more in kind of defining what you're trying to capture with that information. So it's kind of thinking about the denominator as part of the measure, trying to have this process. You have to either figure out that's got to be an imperfect number, or you're going to have to figure out ways to exempt it. The problem if you have things with ways to exempt it is in an EHR system, for it to do it, it has to be able to, it's going to require a checkbox field on the SCC, and that can be cumbersome. And with the tracking results, the EHR systems are imperfect on things that are ordered in the future. So that you don't expect it to come back in a week, you're expecting it to come back year, year and a half, whenever it is. And so when you do that report, having worked with the EHR, a lot of different EHRs and trying to get that out with small practices, that's close to a disaster because it just, it doesn't, you can't, you can spit out a report that says these things are outstanding, but you have no easy way to figure out this is when they were actually due. So it takes it from the existing visit or the existing spent time. It doesn't take it from when the test was actually expected. And so part of that may be the EHR certification or how you grade that, but there has to be some thought with that process. Even though it may be automatically captured that the results come in, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the result should have come.
So actually, that's a great thought. So one solution, so I think we're, as far as existing products, don't be effectively press that. So one solution would be to request that part of the certification process that systems be developed that would allow tracking of patients' practices for return. And it seemed like that might be something that would be, we would want to throw out there. It's a challenge to the vendor community, to whether ONC puts that in part of their recommendation to that, because they're going to tighten up the certification process. They consider that because it's a challenge. We don't know if people are dead. Use that example. So how do you track, you know, people that will return?
So it sounds like, in general, tracking in general is difficult. I
can understand
the levels of tracking.
Well, but I think that the best issue, patient moving issue is not exactly tracking it. It's defining the population. And you don't have a way of really weeding out people from the EHR system. So you don't have a process by which you can say, because you have to keep the record legal. It's not going to delete the record. So it's kind of saying, I'm going to ignore this for the clinical reports, but are there questions, times when I don't want to ignore that for the clinical reports? And just even getting that information is very difficult. And some patients do come back. They're snowbirds, or they're just don't come in until 3 years later. So you don't want to have a system that just throws them out because you haven't seen them. I think with quality measurement, the challenge is you're using a system that's being primarily used for a different purpose, which is, at least in our current system, the documentation and kind of maintenance of the chart in that clinical story. And then you're trying to get information from that story. But you have to assume the parameters by which that story is there when you design that measure.
Actually, I'm wondering if that's the purpose, the operating purpose that we want to carry forward, or whether there's a recommendation about what that record becomes beyond documentation of, you know, I'm thinking about there's all sorts of external information, whether that be patient-reported data or hospital discharge data that is not under your direct control, but is important information about the care of the patient that needs to be deposited somewhere, and I would think in that record. So it's more than just what happens in the confinement and encounter.
It is. It's trying to figure out the whole health story. But I think the challenge with the existing system is in part medical legal, in part if I'm a physician and I'm getting all of this information on all of these different tests done, am I then responsible for knowing this information, containing this information, et cetera, even if that's actually being provided by me? So that's where it gets into kind of a squirrely situation that I don't think they can figure out how to deal with this blob of different sources of data in a different single repository, or if it's just a query-based system. And I think the comments that it's important to
Hello?
Do.
Yeah, this is John Mace. I mean, I think when you know, the EHO would have to be capable of, one, highlighting what the new information was when the doctor logged in, and where's the legal responsibility? Is it on the physician to verify that everything that somebody put in from a personal health record or the hospital is accurate? Suppose there's an abnormal lab value there. It's the obligation of the doctor who didn't order the test to get it. I mean, there's a lot of legal implications with the movement of data back and forth. And, you know, to not consider the malpractice milieu in the conversation is not really realistic.
We can highlight that as a challenge, the legal implications of the movement of data. That all needs to be considered.
Yeah, even in the quality reporting itself. So there are going to be implications if that quality measure is required with the levels and making sure that the information is accurate and being able to claim it's that important legally binding, or is this but just being used for quality improvement purposes. So it's going to be an ongoing issue on multiple fronts.
Mm-hmm. I think Talon's foot was good as far as the record being built now for documentation of visits. And I think it was mentioned before as far as the billing paradigm, billing structure. So when you try to shift this to population management and quality, it's not a perfect fit. So
or even relevance of all information to the care of that patient.
Exactly. And then the concern, it's interesting to me because having been on paper and having been electronic, we certainly hear, and I understand it's easy to share data electronically, so you may get more stuff. But people always have gotten copies of lab test results, et cetera, in the mail, and we've looked at them, initialed them, and it didn't seem to have the same level of angst that the electronic copy seems to. I don't know if other people have experienced that as well.
It's a signal to noise ratio problem because it can be sent so easily electronically.
Yeah.
Now there's a lot more data coming in, and you're responsible for actually looking at that. So, you know, the patient went to Florida, had a chest x-ray, shows a lung mass, but then they just kind of returned to the Midwest, and all of a sudden you're seeing this patient, the chest x-ray, 6 months before, you have no idea if it was acted on.
Right.
The patient doesn't know. And do you track the patient down? And, you know, so from a primary care standpoint,
primary care is easier because in some ways we kind of are responsible for everything. I imagine specialty care is a little bit more difficult. So, yeah, I would. But I think I would be expected to also Now, if I'm a dermatologist, you know, like that would be, I think that's a little bit more of a difficult situation, you know.
Right. Would the dermatology practice want to see, like, every piece of information?
Right.
Oh, not at all.
Well, no, I mean, if your physicians wouldn't have time to see any patients, they'd just basically be in front of a computer screen, like, reconciling
right.
all this crap.
Right, and there's not a whole lot, you really would be expected about that. But one, we talked about shared information. One of the leaders in our organization, his a relative passed away, and he received a notification from the insurance, hey, you know, so-and-so passed away, by the way. We received notification that so-and-so passed away, and he has insurance policy that we're aware of. So it was interesting to me that, you know, I don't have the Social Security death index. It doesn't come to me, but I wonder, could it or should it? You know, should that be an exchange which we should work toward? Seems like it would be reasonable.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those databases that, you know, people query it all the time for research reasons.
Yeah.
I mean,
and people get it because how would that insurance person know?
Right.
Right. Well, they know because of premium payments.
Yeah, I understand that, but when the person passed away, they were able to say, mm-hmm. you know, Kendra, I understand, you know, your uncle passed away, his insurance policy named you. You know, so they knew they must be getting that information. There must be an exchange of information. And
I was thinking
would it be
health insurance
something that, yeah. Oh, yeah, they stopped paying. Yeah. Would it be something that we would want, you know, to consider in our health records?
I'm trying to think, what is the big sort of outcome coordination of care question? Going back to like Dr. Mostajari, what's the big question? You know, a lot of people talk about coordination of care and avoiding readmission, and that's in oncology. We're talking a lot about survivorship care, which involves different specialties and who's responsible for the pelvic exam and the skin exam and the imaging and primary care interface. And it kind of makes me think about the discussion that we're having here, is that I have this piece of this person's care, and I want to define that. I want to be responsible only for that, but I still need to be making sure that this patient is getting what that IOM says that a cancer survivor should be getting. Survivorship care plans are not well integrated yet, but that's what they're trying to get to. So it kind of makes me think, sort of, what is that, like all of us together, what would that big coordination of care outcome look like? Because then a measure would sort of flow from that, and it speaks to integration of our collective health records. It's a little vague, I understand, but I think what's the big question there?
Well, I mean, Farzad mentioned one this morning, closing the referral loop. So if you refer a patient to be another provider, if you're suggesting, you know, how do you then know that the patient actually made the appointment, saw the doctor, you know, and what was the outcome of that encounter?
But, I mean, I think that the risk with measures with any of this is that if you're doing a process in a practice, it depends on many different people playing a role in it. And there might be different substantially different processes depending on the area, if it's an IPA, integrated healthcare system, a Kaiser, or if it's independent structure. So, I'm just trying to give the guidance that you have to be very careful when we look at these kind of care coordination measures, that you're not trying to lock in or just envisioning one straight way of doing the process. Rather, you're trying to measure that it happened at all. And because otherwise you're going to get in a lot of hairy issues and may create more problems than you expect.
Well, and I'm even thinking of closing the referral loop, and how is that going to happen, and what can we learn from how it would happen to then design the measure? Mm-hmm. You know, because we can't just, you know, it's not just in the context of the measure. I mean, I know our whole discussion is in the context of e-measures, but I think it's also tied to just providing better care and making sure that patients are seen when they're supposed to be seen, and they get the, you know, follow-up care coordination piece. And I mean, I think we can.
So so
I think we would make a lot of strides if we could highlight what are the questions we're trying to solve to then think about then how do we approach it from a measure perspective? Do we approach it from a measure perspective?
So there's a measure for eye exam for diabetics, correct? Which is a process measure. So in like your system, Marty, how do you document patients referred for eye exam? How do you close the loop? Did they show up and they didn't show up? And then
yeah, that's a great one. Because with part of that measure is you have to have the specialist input or an image of the retina.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So, and in fact, when we look at mammogram measures, it's not currently required from a measurement standpoint. It basically says, did the person have a mammogram? But if you talk to some of our folks, their opinion is, oh, yeah, and you should have a copy of the report in the chart, which kind of makes sense, you know.
Right.
So we measure them in parallel. You know, did they have a mammogram? Yes, they did. It's a copy of the report in the chart.
So to copy of the report in the chart is the closure of the loop?
Well, for mammogram for us, not in the measures that we submit because that's not required, but we want people to look at that and start thinking about that. For eye exam, it's required, so yes, if the report has
okay.
to be in the chart.
Is the copy on the chart sufficient, or if there was an abnormal finding and the copy's on the chart but no one's done anything about it? So what's the next step?
No, just the eye exam, I mean, I wouldn't really be the person to do something about that, the ophthalmologist. So they ought to, you know. I think sometimes also we have to watch that we don't make it so, like, unattainable, you know.
Right, and different tests will have different levels of responsibility
right.
for different people.
Right? Yeah.
They're all different algorithms.
Yeah, because even getting a copy in the chart is really hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's, you know, a bit of work.
Mm-hmm.
Because the system really isn't set up well to have
mm-hmm.
that recorded.
Hmm.
So you scan it in an appropriate way, or you name it appropriately. Diabetic eye exam.
And just so people kind of understand the workflows, in most practices, three things can happen with a referral. One, you can just tell the patient that you need to go see an eye doctor. You might document that in your text note, but you're not actually ordering a procedure or a test through the system. And that implication is, there's no electronic way of capturing that you made that referral or that you've gotten or tagging information when something comes in to that reference within the you. In some systems, you can actually order a referral using the system to do it. And that really right now is dependent on EHRs and also the workflows within the practice. But in that case, there's a question of sending it to the referring specialist. Are you sending it? Is it the patient sending it, et cetera? And then on the backside loop, you may get a fax order come in. You may get a phone call come in. And so then there's an administrative challenge of tagging that to that original order. So it is very possible for a fax document to come in that says...
Do you mean back to the ordering physician or
yeah.
at the referring? Back
well,
the
let's say, let's just look at just the referral, that I needed to refer a patient for additional treatment to a specialist. And what you're trying to do is close the loop on did they go to that specialist. If they send, depending on what the specialist sent, you may just get it as a fax, you may get it as a print letter. But unless it is tagged to the original order somehow by some staff person or the doctor manually doing it, the computer system does not know that that loop has been closed.
It almost sounds like, I mean, it's another certification rule thing on the easier part, which is requiring that referral piece to be in all the EHRs, right? In terms of sending the referral out. So don't just say, hey, go see your eye doctor. No, document it in a structured place. The messaging piece coming back is obviously a lot more challenging, right? But whether it's HIEs or whatever, how are you going to get, say, an automated message to come back? I mean, you can sequence it and tag it when it goes out with a unique number. So you can kind of tag it to come back. It's the part of how do we get it back? Is it an HL7 message? You know, what
what, you know, as opposed to a fax, does there need to be a structured way to capture it?
Well, yeah, I think, John, you were saying something.
John? Yeah, I mean, electronically, it has to handshake on the way back so that it would come off the outstanding list. So that's one part of the measure. And then the most important part of the measure is, did the doctor read it? Because that's really, you know, it's not just the taking in of the consult. It's, you know, from a quality point of view, it's the reading of the consult. So it's a two-part measure. Otherwise, you have to reconcile the outstanding referrals by hand, which is challenging. And most times when you scan documents into the record, although you can put them in a folder, per se, that folder is not structured. It really sort of sits out there all by itself.
And this is a big problem that we've faced with, even with lab test results, which have extension numbers and you should be able to match, but you send a CBC, you get 8 results or you get 10 results, depending on what lab you're sending. And you might get results that are provisional or temporary or others to follow. But with consults, there's no way to track, is this the final consult, or is this maybe a document that came from the office you referred the patient to saying this is when the appointment is, or the patient wants your full consult to follow, or some hat. And that matching up part, it has to be a manual process. I can't see of any way, we haven't been able to identify any way where you send a patient for a test, other than a lab test, you send a patient for a consult, that you know that this piece of paper that's coming in 3 days later matches back to that particular visit. We just assume if it's coming 3 days later, it goes to that visit. But it could be from 6 months ago when you sent the patient to the same doctor, and it, maybe not 6 months ago, 6 weeks ago, and the letter's just coming late. That's a problem. I don't know how other people would want that to work, but how do you stamp this goes with this without doing it manually?
I mean, and probably oversimplifying it, but if there's a unique identifier tied to each referral, I mean, outside of the, you know, the visit, outside of whatever, and it's just...
It would have to be. You have to send a challenge patient, and when you respond, please put this magic number on the response letter so that I know that this is your final response to this request. Like an extension number for...
Well, see, that's the challenge right there.
That's the challenge, something like this.
Because there's no process by which there's just one number, either... One, associated with the patient. So you have all the patient identification challenges. But two, with the orders. So it's unrealistic to expect a consulting doctor to keep track of what number they're meant to put foot on all of those patient forms. So it goes back to the right person and gets tagged correctly. I mean, it's not a simple
And even
process.
If you match up with the number, even if there was some registry that every time that you requested a consult, you would go to some tool, you would get a 26-digit unique number that identifies the patient, the referring and referee provider. There would still be a way, there still would need to be a way to say this is the final definitive document that goes with that request. You asked me to find out the patient's ejection fraction, I did a scan, here's the result that goes with that request. But maybe there would be two or three pieces of paper that come back with that request, and none of them are final, and they don't work without each other. Can you use the number more than once? I mean, that's the problem. There's no process. There's no standard.
So probably what we ought to do is just, you know, outline some of these problems. We could probably talk about the problems and not get to the questions, but we could outline this.
But from a practical standpoint, one of you suggested to have the referral ordered within the system routine. And you mentioned the labs. So I order now. Labs for my patient that has diabetes. I get a blood count, their name is too. I get a hemoglobin A1C, I get a lipid panel, and I make their liver function tests as they're on a stat. I get those tests back blood count. So I now have to go in to 4 separate reports, whereas in paper, I got one report and it was pretty easy. And after each report I'm going to, I get this pop-up that says, do you want to complete this order? And how about the other 10? Two of which I would have a cardiologist, so they're going to stay on there. So I'm going to get that pop-up every time. So operationally, I just got totally slowed down. And we're not tracking lab results. So there's people probably all around the country that are doing the exact same thing that I am, and I derive no benefit, and the patient derives no benefit other than they watch me.
Of course, right, because you order a CBC, and you get back a report that's got the white count, the red count, all the indices, and everything follow. And then you get another report with the platelet count. Well, those both go to that same one order for CBC. Have you marked it completed when you got that first report? What do you do when the second one comes in? We see that all the time. You have partial results. And that's same with consults. You might get something that says from somebody you refer a patient to, thank you for referring your patient. Here's my assessment. And I have referred the patient to a subspecialist, refer their assessment of this piece of the puzzle, or to another radiologist for a second reading or an ultrasound because there was something on the mammogram or whatever. And that's hard to know what goes with what. That's something that's not a functional measure that was not.
Even just as a
It sounds like we have more folks on the phone, and we'd love to hear from you, but if you could put your phone on mute when you're not talking, we're getting a lot of feedback. Anybody want to say anything first? Okay, I'm sorry.
Just maybe before we implement some issues which create work at the point of care, which is, I think, significant, it would be helpful if it was thought through and it wasn't implemented. The burden wasn't placed at the point of care until there was some benefit from having that burden there.
I think the other component of it is like the lab ordering.
Mm-hmm.
There is the potential that if we say everything should be ordered within the system, there really needs to be a use case on how that works effectively in practice. So right now, that only really works from an operational time perspective if you have a bidirectional interface with each of the labs that you're sending the patient to. And so if you're a non-organized practice, you may have four or five labs you have to send patients to because of insurance requirements or various other components. And many of the labs don't have bidirectional interface, so some of them don't have any interface. And so if we say that, we're then creating double work because they're going to the physician or whoever does it in the electronic has to do it there, and then they have to go and do it someplace else. And so you can duplicate work very quickly if it's not, unless there's a whole system. So that can be a challenge, and it can be very expensive. The lab interfaces aren't free. And so it's not like we're saying that this is a magic thing and this is the best way to do it, but there are also practical implications and financial implications.
We probably should move into our more structured conversation so that we're sure to cover all of our bases. Why don't we start with best practices that came out of both our discussion and the vignettes that have been presented earlier today. And we can categorize these in terms of best practices demonstrated by processes or workflows by the use of structured data or culture.
Okay, I can start real quick. So workflow, point of care, quality measure, data entry, code system, SubMed CT, LOINC, culture, sharing transparency and sharing physician-specific data at the practice level.
Back up.
I think I captured it.
I could see this also putting this on the computer.
Point of care quality measures, data entry, code system, SNOMED, CT, LOINC, sharing physician
transparency, sharing physician-specific quality data at the practice level. Would you say, Marty showed some great examples of that.
Specific data at the
practice level.
Sorry.
So in other words, if you're in a large multi-specialty practice, you'd see how the endocrinologist is doing, the oncologist, cardiologist, primary care physicians can see who they're sending patients to if they're doing a good job.
Yeah, I think at multiple levels even. And I think somebody talked about the three levels today, the provider, the practice, the community. So I don't know that we've conquered communities as well as I'd like to. But
so eventually, by the way, another aspect is quality reporting at the this registry level is we're evolving very quickly to public reporting, particularly for cardiovascular data. For example, right now, the STS registry, which is for cardiovascular surgery, hospitals are voluntarily releasing that data. It's in consumer reports, 2/3 of the hospitals in the United States. Ultimately, we would see that professional organizations might do that for ambulatory care, where they would use these process measures and have public, you know, voluntary public reporting of the care of heart failure patients, for example, at the institutional level, which would be the patient would have knowledge then of the outcomes. So it creates this culture that we're, although the society is going to evolve to public reporting of quality measures. I guess that's...
Isn't Medicare reporting their CQRS?
Hospital
physician
compare is getting rolled out. So,
yeah,
I think the results aren't there yet. But
it's gradually happening, yeah. Depending on where it was, how it was regulated. So with the healthcare reform, various things were stipulated at various times, and it's going through its regulatory process.
First
so
step is, you know, who's participating, you know, and that
right.
We're still in those earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's out, but
yeah.
It's turned into other components that are in it.
How well did they do?
Yeah.
So that's coming next, I think, right?
Eventually, yeah. So it's a very important culture piece that both of you touched on in slightly different ways. I mean, you talked about selecting measures that are important to the practitioners and so that they want it. To actually see the information. And you talked about starting with a small committed group that was willing to be a little bit flexible and live with imperfection. And I think those were both nice examples of kind of adapting the strategy to the environment that you're in.
Yeah, we'll put that down.
Okay, so I gathered small committed group willing to live with imperfections, but I didn't catch the first one.
Using
measures that are
important to the doctor.
Exactly,
yeah.
Sorry. And Bernie, you also mentioned earlier, you said that the payment will follow the practice initiative. So can you give us an example in your practice where you first had the initiative and then rolled it up later to...
Yeah, I'll go back to us meeting because I was at AMA presenting quality reporting and we were using diabetes as our first chronic condition. And then when CQRI came out, it was basically the same measures. So we were able to use that same information.
So was there like an initiative in the practice that, okay, we're going to start looking at our diabetes care?
We had a small committed group just that were involved in Pennsylvania State Collaborative, the Chronic Care Collaborative.
Okay.
So they started to roll that out. And
so the key is probably education and information before the measuring, actually.
I think so, yeah. I think also realizing that most people in practice, and not just the clinicians, the nurses, the assistants, aren't really accustomed to working registries and quality measurement because it's relatively new. So at least appreciating the fact that it's new work that you're asking them to do and a new skill set.
Questions to both of you. So, with neurologists, still the vast majority of our members don't even have an EHR. So, how did you? I know you probably haven't for quite a while, but like a cultural thing for us is overcoming that barrier. There are a lot of our members that you're very senior in our association are ready to retire in 10 years. So they say, you know, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to do PCRS because I'm not going to worry about the 0.5%. But how do you change your culture going forward to be able to kind of warm them up to the idea and then to be able to better assist your members since we're dealing with, you know, small practices off base, which is the majority of our members, to get them to kind of embrace getting into e-measures, EHRs, like, do you guys have any tips or tricks? Or
So I
think... Embrace might be a stretch.
Let's over-tolerate.
One of the cultural issues with physicians. They think they're doing a lot better job than they really are. Mm-hmm. So that if you were to practice with, like, we have a big neurology practice in our town, you know, there's like 30 of them. And so, you know, they do have an electronic record. But if they had, like, if you had, like, some sort of stroke registry or they were submitting data on stroke management, you know, then they could have physicians, so that it would help them share data internally within their practice on how good a job they're doing compared to each other.
That's the thing that we do. We have a registry task force that's looking at that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of the step even before that, just getting them used to going from writing in a, you know, the six files all
yeah.
paper-based, but I know this isn't quite the topic we're looking at.
No, I think that's an important topic, and I think we have a large neurology group, a great group of people, and it was a difficult practice to move on to the EHR, and I think it's a very cognitive specialty, not no pun intended, it's a very cognitive specialty, and it's complex, and there's also subsets of folks within. We have our MS group, we have our
muscular specialized.
We have our Alzheimer's group, there's a whole bunch of subspecialties within it, so I think it's difficult. I'd keep them as close to what they're doing as they can, so if they're transcribing, do a transcription where you can go to the data file and put it in, and only ask them for the stuff that you need. You need to imagine, you need to accomplish, you know, so, and all of that can be preloaded. I think that will help, and then give them something in return, like I talked about our Galenia registry. They basically drew straws, and the short straw had to work with us first. You know, so I have to work with you guys. You know, and now they're like, "Oh, I like this. This is pretty cool. We'll come back."
So the best practices, which is entering data and structured data fields, whereas neurology does a lot of dictation.
Yeah,
but you know, you can for each chronic disease, whether it be dementia, stroke, epilepsy, there's certainly common data elements that could be captured and say, we need to be able to capture this across the practice to demonstrate that we're a high-quality practice.
Yeah, some
so you get, that's a cultural issue where you're saying, you know, this is a practice, a neurology practice that's committed to high quality. We have to be able to demonstrate that. So, you know, from a technical standpoint, then that's why you'd want to have an electronic solution to capture data fields.
I think that's a workflow problem for any specialist, not just neurology, is that most EHRs will be tailored towards the family practitioner who kind of not exactly, they're not going to have the field that they would want to enter, and a lot of the measures that we have developed thus far don't fit neatly into a box or a lab result. They're very much, you know, counseling measures, things that are going to be found in dictation but aren't going to be found in a discrete.
But I think we're getting at is data entry. Is there is a huge cultural change. It's a challenge. People that do it well are going to succeed. But it's the question of successful data entry within the EHR system. And it's making sure that the correct components are captured as structured data. That doesn't mean all the components have to be by any means. I think the other thing is trying to figure out doctors' reactions tend to be, oh, this field isn't quite right, or I have a slightly different nuance of how I want to use this term. And it's getting to a standardization and kind of within medicine on being able to accept that this term is good enough, and then I can refine it through other techniques. And I don't know, I guess that's more of one of the challenges that people are practicing rather than the best practice.
We've come up with a long laundry list of challenges, but
I think we can also phrase some of the challenges maybe as best practices. So,
yeah.
Like, start small, you know, see if you can come to agreement on a small number of data elements. You know, a starting point, and then you can demonstrate hopefully the value of collecting that information in that way or documenting that information in that way.
There was an important point, though, that I think you made about having a tool that's applicable to the specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mm-hmm. Pinnacle clearly met that need for you.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's something comparable to that for dermatology or for.
We have a registry that. It's more like it was kind of an accident. Our only three measures for PQRS we have four this year, but previously we had three only really is melanoma, you know, this health, these practices.
melanoma care. And, you know, we had a, in about 1 year, we have a, with a registry, we have a 500% increase in participation.
So I don't know if that's a gap or if that's practice.
Right.
Having structured data capture relevant to the specialty.
Yeah.
I think that's
when you say that one of the best practices is educating physicians and staff about the importance of capturing this information,
yep,
as structured data.
Right.
Because that's what both of you did, and that's how you actually got them to be able to do it.
Because
so the best practice is educating on the importance.
I think the biggest thing for us is just getting measures into PQRS. This is the first year that we've had more than stroke in PQRS, and we're just finishing up our annual meeting, and 90% of the questions I got are about the measures in PQRS, and now they're excited to try them, which I think will force them to get EHRs and to get involved. And we're working with a couple different vendors to create two new registries, but it's like that's like my biggest takeaway is get them incorporated into a national program.
Yeah, so I mean, the 30% of stroke is related to thromboembolism, and you already have, there's already these process measures on assessing thromboembolic risk for non-valvular AFib. So
those are a hospital ones, and we're talking about the majority of
non-ambulatory.
You're talking AFib.
AFib.
Yeah. And so I get, like, most of our clinicians want measures now that they can use in their clinics or in their solo practices.
Mm-hmm.
So that they wanted, that's why we have epilepsy, Parkinson's, and now the dementia ones will be in there.
Right.
But are you saying there's nothing that would prohibit the neurologists from using the AFib measure?
Precisely.
I think.
Yeah, exactly. They could use the AFib measure, non-valvular AFib thromboembolic risk assessment, which is a very common reason neurologists are seeing patients, but I think one of, on the flip side is what Marty said, you know, each specialty has their own measures that they really have emotional attachment to. You know, like the neurologist may be more emotionally attached to some dementia measure.
But is there any reason to force people to not, I mean, in neurology, it may be that the practice can come up with their own measure. I mean, in some ways, the ultimate purpose of quality measurement is to be able to manage your own patients and not necessarily always have the perfect measure that's always been validated from everybody else. It's the ability to do that and check findings. And so in some ways, the measures we're looking at are kind of trying to get as a stepping stone to the ultimate goal, which is essentially easy measurement on customized measures. And so you have to be careful when you're saying, oh, well, it's just PQRS and I just want more PQRS measures, that do you really, or do you just want to try to guide your physicians on how to collect structured data to do quality reporting?
I don't think the focus is, you know, just on PQRS, but the focus is on reducing the burden for the physician that they're not doing, you know, 16 different measures for 10 different programs. So we do develop, you know, plenty of measures. The majority of them are not in PQRS, but those that are in PQRS are those ones that are the ones that are going to get adopted most readily. So I agree that you're not just focusing on developing measures for pay-for-performance. Our focus is on patient outcomes and improving quality of care. But if you can use one measure for MOC, you can use it for PQRS, you can use it for your internal TI, you can use it for JACO, whatever you're going to want to use it for, that is what at least our membership has said they want from us. They don't want to be doing a zillion different measures for different programs. They want them to be, you know, verbatim one to the next, not slightly modified to meet a MOC requirement.
But what you're talking about then is for measurement for either payment or regulatory requirement, which is very different than just measurement in general. So are we concentrating on measurement for the regulatory and payment environment, or are we concentrating on what needs to be in place to do measurement in practice?
Everything we do is evidence-based. That's what the evidence tells us, and where the gaps in care and where there's importance for the measure.
I think for the context of our discussion here today, I mean, the charge from HHS to NQF, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but was to identify what are the issues from sort of a national level quality reporting enterprise.
Although
they're not to say that, you know, those all aren't important. Know, issues for consideration, but
we've also moved, I think, into gap areas. So maybe we could amplify on that. I think you touched on it. Are there others? I mean, there were a number that came up in the conversations and the questions after the scenario that I saw. A lot of them overlap. I feel like. One of them was this issue of terminology and standards, or a lack of standardization around terminology and data entry or capture.
So, actually, Kinder might want to refer. So, it, from a cardiology perspective, we addressed it at the society level. We created a top 100 data element library, and so that's been published. We actually used the, as a model, CDISC, which is, you know, National Library of Medicine, has a taxonomy, nomenclature. So I think professional societies have to set the standards, what standardized terminology, and also even structured data sets that then the vendors could all say, okay, this, thank God, this is, you know, they've actually come to a conclusion, and harmonize that between specialty societies and AMA, for example. Real important work. It's kind of foundational work that hasn't been completed yet. Oncology actually has quite a few, because the NCI has this CA big. You know, I think they, you know, so they have, there's a lot of terminology in oncology around certain cancer conditions. So that's been helpful. So anyway, there are some standards out there, but there needs to be more harmonization across societies. So,
for the ones who've done it.
And it's also getting to the EHR vendor. And I think that in the presentations you all said that if I didn't have it entered in the right place in the EHR, even if I'm calling it the right thing. So it's making sure that that is, that that's also a process. It's a best practice, making sure that it's documented in the same,
So, for example, So one way for that to occur, the best practice would be to work with organizations, standards organizations, for example, and I referred to IHE, Integrating the Healthcare Enterprise. That activity is connected with all the vendors. The vendor community annually gets together in Chicago for what's called a Connect-a-thon to demonstrate that they can use the standard in exchanging data. And so the engineers, clinicians are working on, a library of terms, medical terms, essentially a taxonomy, and also talking about coded and structured data fields for specific specialties. So that's part of that process. So,
right. So I think just to circle back on that best practice, looking to the professionals, the specialty societies to help define what information is important to capture,
if
their specialty, and then taking that a step further, working with the clinicians and the EHR vendors, that those fields are presented in a way that makes sense with the workflow.
So another gap, Marty, that you pointed out about variations in measure specs, and I think, Kendra, you commented on this issue, or somebody, about whether this is an evidence-based standard or a consensus standard, and is it flexible or not flexible, but this whole issue of what are the specs of harmonizing the specs of a measure,
that'd be really
so
helpful.
That there's consistency.
Well, and it's the specs across departments, too, so PQRS and the NQF measures don't match exactly.
Right.
So from a practices standpoint or a vendor standpoint, they actually have to build two different reports because they're slightly differently defined. And so from the high level, they might seem, oh, we're measuring the same thing and this is the same measure, but from a practical standpoint, it's not. So trying to make sure that the same, literally the same measure is used universally in all of the programs.
Yeah, and it's not just the government programs. It's, you know, Highmark, exactly.
Yeah.
They all choose different ones.
Or slight nuances at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, we could acknowledge that, you know, HHS is clearly committed to aligning specifications within their program, but a gap would still be private payer implement program.
Mm-hmm. Well, but what they've done, at least in their meaningful use page 2 in the DRM, is they list all of the times this measure is referenced, but the actual measure is different.
So if I read the NQF measure to the CQRS measure, and then sometimes they do JTO or CCHIT. Yes, they're unifying on the same high-level measure concept, but they're still not unifying on the technical components of that measure.
And to a certain extent, I think some of those differences, it will be difficult to streamline them across the board. Like if you look at CQRS, it's a reporting program, so you have to count eligible cases in addition to calculating performance.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also learned that in trying to take a measure that was developed when all we knew was really claims, specify that for EHRs, you know, the data isn't stored in the same way. And you can also, I think there's different nuances depending on what the data source is.
I understand it, but from a practical standpoint and a practice, that means that you're not standardizing the measures because you still have to be able to do all of those different variations with that same measure.
Okay.
And that's the challenge. It's that, yes, I understand that there are the different data sources and there are all of these components, but from a practical standpoint, that means I have to do this measure four different ways, depending on what program I'm looking at or whatever the implications for the vendor are. So the vendor also has to develop four different ways of reporting the same measure.
So this pertains to number three. A recommendation would be harmonization efforts across, and again, to some extent, the professional societies have to take a leadership role because, in other words, there are all these different entities that are trying to collect quality data, and they're a little bit out of sync, and so we need to harmonize the data quality measure collection process across.
Are you talking about the collection forms or the measures themselves, or like, you know, one measure may be very slightly different than the other, but the outcome of the measure is, like, what the measure is trying to measure?
Right,
it
needs to be harmonized across, and so in other words, if the neurologists are proposing a quality metric measure that is a little bit out of sync with the primary care, you know, to make sure that check with the other specialty organizations that already have proposed a measure, maybe it's close to identical but with the same outcome, why not work together and harmonize that process? So harmonization seems to be a recommendation across, you know, the measure developer community.
So not just on the measure concept level, but also on the reporting method.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And some of it has to be done almost on all levels. I mean,
yeah.
It can't just be. This is the what I feel like HHS has largely done is looking at that high level outcome, and then identifying all these different measures that basically concentrate on that outcome, but there also needs to be harmonization based on the guts of the measure and also the technical reporting requirements.
That's something like the National Quality Measures Clearinghouse. They added some more information to their website, you know, specifically about, because it's hard to find information. You can find, you know, I don't know how many people played with it, but they have, you know, some basic information about the measures, but getting down to the nitty-gritty of the technical specifications, it's sometimes really hard to find that information to get to the appropriate website. But if there was a way to, you know, put all that information clearly out there so you can see exactly what the collection tools are and what the specific specifications are, the denominator, exclusions, everything, then you'd be able to do a lot more of that harmonization from the measure itself through the actual collection tools.
You're just talking over, Frazier. Three pieces of harmonization or alignment, right? The actual specification from the measure development perspective, how you say it across programs, and you're talking about how do you create the e-measure, which I think is the NQF measure authoring tool, sort of that emerging standard, and you're talking about how do you report the data out from your practices to CMS, ONC, whoever. And, I mean, I guess the good news is, you know, QRDA, if you guys are familiar with that, is part of an emerging standard, I guess, and that's what PQRS uses. There's a pilot going on for this current year with that program that sort of lets meaningful use participants use that structure and submit data through vendors and data submission vendors to sort of qualify for both programs. But there are a lot of challenges, so we're back to the chicken and the egg because, you know, to really get some of these, even some of the simpler measures, more so the complex measures, into that measure authoring tool, it's nowhere near where it needs to be, and that's not a knock on NQF at all. It's just the complexity, you know, trying to keep up and keep in sync with where ONC and CMS want to go with the measure concepts, and again, back to what the technology allows and what the infrastructure allows.
And not just the EHR technology and infrastructure,
right,
but also the measure specifications,
right,
and production,
yeah,
which I think,
and that's what, you know, that is a huge challenge as we're finding out as we're trying to build some of these measures. So, I mean, it's not really an answer, but it's just, I mean, there's
the gap.
Yeah.
Well, so would the best practice be to,
I mean, continue, there's a lot of brainstorming going on with the right people
with in the existing processes to do this, but also not to just throw tons of measures in until they're ready to, that they've gone through this process, this harmonization process?
Ideally, I guess you would say, yeah, you know, you'd like to stabilize on the back end before you build measures that, you know, that you can't really implement in the right way until these things are ready to roll. But
on the other hand, we can't really just stop where we are.
Yeah,
I mean,
you
we
can't.
Need to continue.
Not
and
really.
I think Kate Goodrich made the point this morning that, you know, we need to be able to move forward in a methodical kind of disciplined way.
1 foot on the ground, 1 foot going forward.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But how do you do that with the pace and the deadlines and, you know, what the practices are up against versus the legislation and the timeline?
And I mean, I would just encourage everybody in this room that if you haven't commented on the proposed rule, you know, these are the types of things that they need to hear, because otherwise, you know, they probably will go forward with, you know, certain things, you know, certain concepts. And
yeah.
The issue about usability that Dr. Griffin brought up this morning.
Yeah.
No, so actually the comment period's still open, so
summary 7.
Yeah.
There was another area we spent a lot of time talking about, which is this whole issue of external data and capturing it, documenting it, validating it, whether that be from other care sources, patient-reported data, information about death. And so I think a recommendation there would be to look at ways of capturing that and incorporating it.
And can you leverage HIEs? And again, that's a whole other thing in and of itself that has challenges. But the other thing I think, and, you know, if we try to give best examples as well, and obviously come up with a lot of challenges which are real, you know, they mentioned earlier the Electronic Measure Issues Group, EMIG, and that is a way. I mean, that is a best practice example where you have the right mind and the right people in the room to try to work through some of the issues. So it's not a solution today, like, hey, we've addressed everything, or that group's addressed everything, but continued kind of participation from, you know, it's open to anybody to be part of that and listen to those discussions and see, you know, what input I think we as a whole can provide to help move some of that brainstorming forward to get to the, you know, the real change measures and the real ways to standardize how they're specified. It's really, I mean, I guess it's sort of a backdoor best practice, but it's one that I think needs to continue.
So that would go, how do we rethink what we're looking for? To address, for example, the scanned in information, the unstructured data fields, there's new technologies that are being developed for natural language processing that you could take unstructured data and then get into structured data fields. So that would be one way to rethink, you know, because there's scanned documents that are coming from different practices that are stuck in the EMR. So that'd be a way to rethink that as far as data entry.
Well, the challenge with that is we're also relying on the reliability of those new software systems.
Right.
It's something to expect that we need to look at more in detail, but if we're talking from a patient safety perspective, that might not be, I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's not perfect.
You still need to go back and validate everything.
Yeah, but rethink what we're looking for. That's kind of a fall under that.
And I guess that's also rethinking the operational measures and making sure that if this operational measure
over-refining a particular workflow, or is it trying to focus on what the goal of the outcome measure is rather than exactly how that is achieved?
So we answered all those questions, sir. Let's see what.
Can you give an example of what you just said, so that I can understand?
So if you're looking at care coordination, we talked a lot about the referral tracking and back and forth like that. The measure has to be at a high enough level that people can have 5 or 6 different processes in place in which they're doing that tracking, rather than trying to just highly define one of those processes. So like with referral tracking, my staff might be reviewing all of this and tagging it, and some practices may be entering it in the note or however it is. But what we really want is that it happens. And I think we care less about how it happens, especially since we don't know what the best process is, or there's not a best process right now.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that gets you back to a checkbox. That outcome, at least as an interim step, which we know people don't necessarily like, but in certain cases, I think, and I think that's how we were going about trying to spec that measure initially, as sort of a building block, because there are no standards like we discussed and how you get. We all have good thoughts on how do you get the message back and what the technology can allow, but in the interim, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, there are 10 different ways people are maybe getting the info back and forth, and short term, maybe that's a viable way to go about trying to start towards a more meaningful, pardon the pun, measure.
That actually gets to some of the issues around number 2 of mechanisms to enhance data and workflow capability, of having multiple ways that it can be done so that practices can find one that fits their model, their environment, their workflows, and not just a rigid way of the only way to do it.
So you code flexibly so that you can pick things up in various spots. Or you have the ops terms that could be entered in various spots.
Yeah, that's even important within individual practices as far as workflow and data entry. There's multiple sources of mechanisms. Different physicians like to put data in. Others would rather just be a data editor.
I also found your 5-click methodology, particularly resonant. I mean, if it's very difficult to do, it's not going to be done reliably.
Right.
Not
done. It's either not going to be done at all, or it's going to be done incorrectly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of the upper limit.
Not minimum.
upper limit of reality. Data entry reality. Really.
I think that's
for an encounter, yeah.
I think you guys already hit on the PHR as part of an alternate way, trying to build on those grants and the Beacon projects and whatnot. Granted, it has to be validated and all that, but I think you hit on that.
Or any patient-centered information.
Any patient.
I guess in that
industry. Well, maybe there has to be a process of reconciling that information so that it can be incorporated into the quality measure.
What happens on, say, CAP surveys now? I mean, where it's coming from the patient, granted, the phone interview or however they do it. But so, obviously, the analysis is weeding out the bad data, I guess. So, I mean, is there a framework to use to where, it has to be validated, but it's not that we're just starting from scratch? I mean, whether it's coming directly from the patient, they're entering, say, into a patient health record or into some kiosk or what have you, versus, hey, they provided via a survey.
I mean, there are tons of different ways that the data can come in. And at the end of the day, it still has to be validated or accepted by the clinician as being what I want as part of the medical record.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying on this, say the CAP survey, that's not at the clinician level. That's been federally sort of CMS, right?
I mean,
conducting that.
Well, actually, the practice has to conduct that.
Okay.
I mean, it's a survey that's open to anybody to use.
since it was developed publicly, but the practice actually has to be the one that administers that survey.
So can you leverage how the validation processes happen there against, say, PHR or true patient reported data going right into an EHR? Is there anything that we can, you know, leverage?
The mechanisms are so different, I think it's going to be difficult to do.
So I think what I'm hearing is a reconciliation process for any external data that will ultimately end up back in the EHR, reside in the EHR, and then potentially be used for quality measurement or anything else. It's actually, I think, bigger than reconciliation. It's more efficient mechanisms to obtain it, validating it, how to integrate, incorporate it into quality measurement.
Discrete fields, yeah.
So do we want to step back and summarize, or do you think we've covered our ground?
Let's summarize.
Okay. Do you want to read what you've looked at, or do you want me to read off my hand? Okay.
Whatever.
Okay. In terms of best practices, the issue of capturing data at the point of care in an active way rather than having to go back and get it. That
one was also vendor involvement, too. It was great in terms of capturing the point of care through your vendor application.
Right. Coding systems. I mean, this came from you, Marty, but I didn't put a modifier on that. What's the best practice there?
I think actually, you always
talk about SNOMED
CT. Using SNOMED CT as far as nomenclature, standardized nomenclature for problem lists, and then using specific examples of coded data.
Coded systems, okay.
LOINC for laboratory, RX norm for beds would be another standard. So making sure that, and most of the vendors have pretty well adopted most of this stuff already. So, it's just, I guess, important that we kind of keep reviewing the standards that everyone wants to play by.
Okay.
Helen, we had, when you said capturing data at the point of care, and Mike, you mentioned feedback at the point of care as well.
Right. So
I think that's just so helpful because
then you know what you didn't do. So sometimes in medicine,
in less than
two clicks. Happen, yeah.
That whole issue, in less than five clicks.
Yeah, there you go.
The whole issue of transparency, particularly physician-specific, capturing data at the individual practice and community level, managing the culture in terms of selecting measures that are important to the clinicians involved, and starting with a small committed group that's willing to be somewhat flexible. The issue of educating, providing information before going in directly into measurement is helpful in terms of data capture. Recognizing that this is new work requiring new skill sets and therefore training for clinicians and support staff. Can't read my own writing. Sharing the data, using the data to kind of share with clinicians about this is what we're finding and this is what it means about the practice and helping them or using them to refine the meaning of the data and are we capturing it correctly. Entry into structured fields, we've talked about that. The issue of auto-populating information into registries and so forth, we didn't talk about that. We didn't pull that out of the string, but I think it is a best practice.
Okay.
Which is really another way to say it is data reuse, reusing data that's already entered in a structured field. So, actually, Marty touched that a couple times.
Yeah, I think the more that you do that, people don't have to.
There's the whole issue of harmonization at multiple levels. There's the need for harmonization and standardization of terminology and code sets and structured fields. The issue of harmonization of data specifications and what measures are being used, output across programs. Some of this is best practice, and some of it is cash and recommendations. The use of external data in terms of obtaining it, incorporating it, and validating it. Recommendations was also exploring some of the new technologies such as natural language
processing and improving the reliability and information about the reliability of those systems. Okay, I'm not sure I got it all.
It's training people on the importance of capturing the information. So it's not just training them on this new task, but it's training on why. I mean, it gets us in basis with why am I doing this?
I think that's partly back to, and I can't pronounce his last name, my keynote speaker upstairs early, about the eye on the prize. You know, what's the goal?
Right.
I think the goal has to, though, also be something that the person that's entering the data gets, too. Like, there has to be value to them.
And I think that's actually, Will, I mean, I think that's the point we're trying to make about educating and informing folks before you jump into the measurement.
Yeah. I mean, it's educating on where I record the information, but I have to educate them on
why
am I going to do this, or they're not going to do it.
Okay, we're coming close to our time. Are there other points that folks think are really important to capture and transmit to the broader group?
I think you got it.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was recommendations, staff, and...
Okay, then I
do want to say thank you.
Anybody on the phone still that would like to offer any input or insight into what we've been talking about?
No, I think you've covered it.
Okay, then I think we're going to adjourn the session at this point. We will be reconvening in the larger room with the entire group at 2:30. Why don't you plan to be there no later than 2:25 so that we can get started on time? Thank you very much.
You can hang out here for a while if you'd like to use some laptops, whatever, because they don't want us on the ninth floor yet.
Is there anyone on the phone still?
To one small room. I mean, two smaller rooms, and now they've got to open the back up.
I think we're all having some access problems down here, though. That's the,
yeah, that's a problem.
So DOD basically.
Yeah, you must have to be lobbying. They could, if they learn how to do it. This thing is go back.
Yeah, and I mean it's pretty sophisticated stuff. So I said,
hey, drop me a link. I'd like to talk to our FQA. Interesting stuff.
Chart from baseline to current.
Yeah.
because it's very predictive.
So, Kendra, thanks.
Yeah.
I'll be there as long as I can. You're more articulate.
But that would be kind of a cool
thing. We covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah.
Actually, we got to do a special
Let me get in what I
got.
Could have spent like a couple more hours.
Respiratory measures for ALS that will be coming out. One is really just assessing them for brain
sufficiency. Is there anyone still on the call?
This is the operator. I'm still here.
Okay. Has everyone hung up?
The one participant we did have did disconnect, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Focusing on a multidisciplinary approach where the measure calls for the neurologist to work with at least one and refer them for follow-up
eval. Ma'am, this is the operator. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. So I think go ahead and probably end the call. If we had someone else on, I would have just told them the number that they could call. Since there's no.
I'm wondering. I
So we'll since you're adjourning the meeting, will anyone be reconvening on this line or?
Not on this line.
Oh, yeah.
So we can go ahead and
just go ahead and disconnect it. Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye.